And I'm talking with Merle Curdy in Madison, Wisconsin, on May 11th, 1982. Well, Merle, to begin with, I noticed you were born in Nebraska, in Papillion, Nebraska. Did you grow up in that town?
Yes. My memories of it are fairly vivid. It was a small Nebraska town of 500 people, five struggling churches, and five flourishing saloons.
It was close to Omaha, wasn't it?
At that time, physically, yes. But at that time, it was quite remote because the only way of getting to Omaha was by a Union Pacific train. And the train was the coming of the train each day to Omaha and the coming of it back at night were the big events in this town. Now it's actually a suburb of Omaha. It's been almost incorporated in Omaha. But in those days, it was a very self-sufficient community, and one went to Omaha only rarely for major shopping or health purposes. The town was founded, I think, just about 30 years before I was born, so I was, in a sense, fairly close to the frontier aspect of it. It was a town that where everyone really literally knew everyone else and their affairs, but there were social lines in the town, even as close to the frontier as 30 years and as small as this. There were some families which were the prestigious families, the banker particularly, and the one doctor, and two or three others. My family was somewhat peripheral, but socially it was identified with these well-to-do people, though my father was not well-to-do. He was a pharmacist. He had the drugstore, which he had inherited from his father, who was a medical MD with a medical degree from the medical school at the University of Prague. And he had combined practice with the drugstore, and he was a very well-trained doctor for his day. The Charles University was a very important university. Its medical school had a great reputation. But
when did he immigrate?
He came in 1865 and bought a farm in Illinois. Was going to combine practicing with farming. Well, he knew nothing about farming. He came from a patrician family in Switzerland, a very old family. Well, every family is old, but this family had built the family house in the 16th century, and the family still owns this house in Rapperswil in Switzerland. My grandfather was a free thinker. And this was an extremely Catholic and conservative town in St. Gall. And I think his reasons for coming to America were because he found it uncomfortable as a free thinker to be practicing in the family town where everyone knew him and where the family had been and still was very important. And he was the black sheep who had in the revolutions of 1848, when he was a student at the gymnasium in Zurich and the University of Zurich, had been on the side of the revolutionists of 1848, as his family was very conservative and very Catholic. He married a girl from Lausanne who was a very, very patrician, very, very wealthy.
What was her name?
Yes, very wealthy.
And what was her name?
Yeah, and very Catholic. So she was disowned and disinherited for marrying my grandfather, a free thinker. And I think they came to America because they thought perhaps things were better. She very reluctantly gave up the Catholic Church, and I think always felt the need of some kind of religion, but my grandfather felt quite comfortable without any church connection at all.
Did you remember either one of them?
I remember my grandmother died before I was born, but I remember my grandfather. He was a very gentle, sweet soul, regretting that my Yankee mother from Vermont didn't see any point in sending the children to a German-speaking parochial school. He was willing to swallow his prejudice against religion if we went to a school and learned German. He felt that everyone ought to know some foreign language. And my mother saw no point in that, so we didn't learn German. But I remember him saying, you ought to learn German. He spoke High German as well as the dialect, of course, and quite good English and French. Well, anyway, that was my mother came from Vermont with her family, and my grandfather on that side had been a farmer in Vermont and really a businessman, and he had the idea of coming west and buying cattle and shipping them. Hmm. I don't know just what his scheme was, but he settled in Papillion because it was on the railroad and fairly near the stockyards of Omaha. Hmm. And he succeeded very well. He did very well in this, but my Vermont grandmother was of no mind to stay in this godforsaken place with no mountains and hot, dry summers. Hmm. So they went back to Vermont, but leaving my mother because she was going to marry my father. I had a Vermont background on one side and spent a great many summers as a boy in Vermont. Hmm. Because a part of the agreement was that my mother would spend part of every summer in Vermont with her parents and bring the children. I think my grandfather paid the railway fare and so forth. And they had bought back their old farm, but he went into country real estate and didn't do much farming. But with my Vermont cousins, I learned to climb the mountains, the Green Mountains, and go camping at Lake Champlain. And so I had a very strong feeling for Vermont.
What was their name, your grandfather's name?
Hunt.
Hunt.
And my Vermont grandmother was a descendant of Seth Warner, of the Green Mountain Boys, a family that moved up to Vermont from Connecticut in the 18th century. And they were good, strong, sturdy people, practical, and very devoted to my mother, as she was to them. So I had the two sides, and I think I learned to appreciate America as much from my father than as I did from my mother and her family. They more or less... They were quite conscious of being Vermonters, but I think my father had a very deep appreciation of what America was. I have some letters from my grandfather that my grandfather wrote to friends or relatives in Switzerland.
Hmm.
And he was a Democrat in politics and very appreciative of America. Though there were some things he didn't like about it. He didn't like the tremendous amount of patent medicines that the farmers would buy and then call him when they were desperately sick and he could do very little for them. They'd often taken what he thought to be useless or the wrong kind of medicines. Anyway, this is where I grew up, and I can't remember too much about my school because... I only remember that I was no good at sports, but that I liked to read a lot, and we had many there were a great many Czechs and Germans in the community, and my father had friends among all of these people. We used to see them socially on their farms. They were prosperous farmers. They would always serve wine and cake on a Sunday afternoon. Mm-hmm. I remember all of those things. But I remember my Vermont boyhood much better where I really learned to love the outdoors and so on.
How many people were in your family? How many children?
I have an older brother who became a medical doctor, and a sister. Just the two others. I was the youngest one, and spoiled by them all.
Those railroad trips must have been something.
Yes, they were very interesting because they were long trips. It took about 3 days.
I was going to ask how long you
got to Vermont. It took about 3 days.
Did you go in a Pullman so you could sleep?
Oh yes. We always went in Pullman. My mother had a sense of what was the proper thing to do. She wouldn't have gone on a coach. I'm sure if she had to go on a coach, she wouldn't have done it. But she was very democratic and disliked the snobbishness of anyone in this town who put on airs, because she felt this was ridiculous. And she was on very good terms with everyone. She had a very gifted personality and an excellent sense of human relations. And she was very good looking and a good dancer and very popular in the town. My father was much more somber and serious and terribly hard working. My mother had a great deal of the sense of the joy of life, and she went her own way to a considerable extent, doing things that she thought made life interesting and attractive. Then we moved to Omaha, where my father gave up the drugstore business and became an officer in a mutual farm insurance company. So we lived in Omaha. And there,
when did you move to Omaha? How old were you?
I was in the sixth grade. I didn't like grammar school, partly because I wasn't good at sports and so forth, and was more or less a loner. But in high school, I sort of found myself, and I went out for debating, and I was editor of the school magazine, and in dramatics, such as they were, and I had some very good friends, and belonged to a social club, which pretentiously regarded itself as a Greek letter high school fraternity. The snobbishness I didn't like, but I enjoyed the parties and dances and so on. Well, I became sort of social after having been very withdrawn and apart from most kids. I had two very, when I got to high school, that I sort of, these were my best days up to then, except my summers in Vermont, which I idealized and romanticized and loved. I had two very interesting high school teachers in history. One of them had, in those days, you could take, even in a relatively small high school, 4 years of history. You had Greek and Roman history the first year, and there I had a very beautiful young woman by the name of Judah Bednar. We all fell in love with her. And I remember her telling us about, in Greek history, of the Acropolis, and she very vividly described it. I supposed, of course, that she'd been there. And I came to be very fond and read Plutarch's Love, and Plutarch's Lives, and things which a freshman in high school normally, I guess, wouldn't be expected to do. And she encouraged me and suggested things to read or gave me books to read. And she was very delightful. And then she dropped out of high school to be married, and I lost complete track of her. Some 15 years ago, I guess, I was getting an honorary degree at the University of Nebraska. And as the procession formed, one of the marshals said, "There's a very little, very, very old lady who says she's come by Omaha, from Omaha by bus, just to see you. And would you just step out of the line? We'll hold the procession up while you speak to her." And she was indeed very little and very old. And she said, you may remember me as Miss Bednar." And I said, "Miss Bednar, how could I ever forget you?" But I said, "You dropped out of high school to get married, and I didn't know your name or where you were." And I said, I have now the great pleasure of telling you, which is very true, that you were the one who first got me interested in history.
Huh.
And she smiled and said, I would like to believe that's true. And I said, well, it is. And she said, well, you may be interested in knowing that, and I told her about, I remember her description of the, she said, you know, at that time I'd never been to Greece, but I've been there since, and I've been there twice. And is that I've kept my hand, I'm a great-grandmother, but I've kept my hand in educational work, parents, teachers, and all kinds of educational things. And I said, when I read in the Omaha World Herald that you were getting an honorary degree, I just decided I must come down and say hello to you. So we corresponded at Christmas time until she died.
What was her married name?
First name was Bednar. It was a Czech, she was a from a Czech, Protestant Czech community.
Huh.
In Nebraska, and had gone to the University of Nebraska, which was the first university in this country to establish a chair of Czech.
That's interesting.
And the Czechs come into some of Willa Cather's novels. I forgot what her, because I hadn't known her name. She
yes.
told me then, but I sort of went.
That's a marvelous story, though, running into her.
It was so nice to see her again. It made me think how important it is to tell our teachers when they have meant something to us. And only today I had a letter from someone who was in one of my classes here in 1945 and 6. And she writes from New Jersey. She'd run into a former student of mine from Columbia, one of the PhDs that I sponsored in 5 years that I was there. And they got to talking about their teachers that had meant something to them. And he said that I was the one. And she said, well, he was the one I had at Wisconsin who meant so much to me. And, and he gave her my address. And since then, after having four children, she has gone back and done graduate work at Columbia and is now just getting a degree at Union Theological.
Oh.
It was a very appreciative letter. And I thought, well, how nice to tell. And I'm sorry I didn't do this more often than I did. The other teacher was had a master's degree from the University of Chicago in history, and she was the one who I think I had Miss Bednar in medieval and modern history as well as Greek and Roman, and then had Cecilia Chase in English history and an American history. I had 4 years of history, which is.
That is
now impossible. There's no high school in the country where you could do this. Miss Chase was a very interesting teacher, and she loved history, and particularly American history. And she encouraged me to go to Harvard. And it was clear that I would like to be an historian as early as high school, thanks to these two women in great part, and also to the fact that I liked history much better than I did anything else except English. And I said, well, my parents couldn't afford to send me to Harvard, and I'm going to the University of Nebraska. She took a rather dim view of the University of Nebraska, although there were some good historians there, and said, well, I think you could get a scholarship at Harvard, and you have to probably take entrance exams. I said, I'll look it up, and she found that there were scholarship, particularly for high school people, public high school people from the West. Harvard was beginning to try to get students from high schools instead of just the prep schools of the East. And so I took the Harvard entrance exams and under her stimulus and did get a kind of a scholarship, which involved working for it. When I got to Harvard, I found that this wasn't a free gift. That I had two very onerous duties. One was to Harvard, in those days, required attendance classes. And there was a monitor who sat in the back, a student. And he had a chart and had to report absences. Well, the football men were, I was just a freshman, you see, and timid. Here were all of these sophisticated boys from prep schools. And these huge football players, and they tried to intimidate me to get me to overlook the fact they were absent. And this caused a very great conflict on what to do. My humanity told them to close my, told me to close my eyes, and also my desire not to be disliked. And the other, my conscience told me I have to follow the rules of the university, which had given me this working scholarship. The other job was running an adding machine, and I had never run an adding machine before. It was I was a kind of assistant to a professor of education. I had no idea what it was he was doing, what these figures meant, and I know I made a lot of mistakes. And I was just right enough to realize that what I was doing was probably completely invalid, that I'd made too many mistakes. So I told his graduate student assistant, the young man, I said, you know, I'm not any good at these figures. And he said, well, don't worry. He said, I think the whole thing is very much open question. I said, let's go ahead. And I thought, well, this doesn't seem to quite fit the Harvard conception of excellence. However, from that point on, I did have good scholarships requiring no duties, just keeping up your grades.
So you just had to do that, those two jobs your freshman
year?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I wanted to ask you, going back to your childhood, were there any particular books you read that got you interested in history in addition to these teachers? Were you much aware of the frontier experience? You were in, really, sort of, the frontier.
Not really, no. I just knew that Papillion was a relatively new town, and that it had been quite new when my grandparents came there. And there were, my father was a hunter, and went hunting for wild ducks and so forth. And I was aware that, you know, it was a place where there was a great deal of closeness to the outdoors. I liked going fishing, and my father took me fishing, but I didn't do any hunting.
Mm.
He gave me a 22 target to practice on, as he felt every boy should know how to do. He was a Democrat like his father, and a friend of Bryan.
Oh, he knew Bryan.
Yes. Well, he knew Bryan, and introduced Bryan, I think, in the campaign of 1896 when Bryan came to Papillion. But that was before my time. And he was something of a populist guy, Bryan. And so his sympathies were with the people who weren't as well off, and he distrusted big money and big corporations and privileges and what might be called the plutocracy, I guess. He ran for some local offices and had some, I don't remember what ones, he always kind of maintained. I remember when we went to Omaha shortly after, it was the campaign of 1912, and he took me to hear three of the candidates. I heard T.R. and Bryan and Wilson. Taft, I think, didn't do any campaigning. He just stayed at home. But I heard the three candidates. So that was three of the Debs was running about. My father was interested in Debs and said if he weren't a Democrat, he would vote for Debs, but he was going to vote for Bryan. And
did you ever meet Bryan?
No. I heard it when I was a senior in college, just before Prohibition went into effect in 1920, Bryan came to Harvard and in New Lecture Hall gave an oration in favor of the prohibition. And he couldn't have had
This is Edwin M. Kaufman, and I'm talking with Merle Curdy in Madison, Wisconsin, May 11th, 1982. Well, Merle, you were born in Papillion, Nebraska. Would you discuss Papillion? How large a town was it?
Well, it was 500 people with five struggling churches and five saloons. There were many German-speaking and some Czech-speaking settlers. It was only 15 miles from Omaha, but one could get to Omaha only by the Union Pacific train, so that it was actually a very isolated country, county seat town.
I think you mentioned about the trains coming and going.
Yes, the trains were very important, the coming and going, once a day each way. The two blacksmith shops and the livery stable were the most important institutions after the railway station. The blacksmiths did a great deal of business. They were quite prosperous. One of them was the first person in town to get an automobile. The social structure of the town was relatively simple, but there were a few families that considered themselves somewhat better than the others. This was rather ridiculous in view of the small size of the town. My own mother was a Vermonter and very democratic in her conception of things, and on very good terms with everyone, including the so-called elite and everybody else.
I think you mentioned that the elite were the banker and the
doctor, and I can't quite think. My own family, because of the fact that my grandfather had been a physician, was, I think, considered a part of this, but we didn't have nearly as much money as the banker had. And some of the wealthy farmers who had married wives with some pretensions at education. I remember one, for example, whose wife had been to the Academy, the Sacred Heart in Omaha, a Catholic boarding school to which the well-to-do sent their daughters. Well, in any case, my father was a pharmacist. He had the drugstore in town, and was very amused when we first got a telephone, when a German-speaking farmer came in and wanted to know whether it was possible to speak German on this new fangled instrument. My father thought that was a great joke. He was a kind of a populist Democrat in his politics, and ran for, and I think was occasionally elected to some local or county office, and was an admirer of William Jennings Bryan, whom he introduced in 1896 when Bryan spoke in Papillion, Nebraska. And
you talked a little about your grandfather, who was educated in Prague.
Yes, he was a Swiss of the patrician class, so-called, a very old and well-established family with a great many professional people. And he, as a student at the University of Zurich, had been very much interested in and sympathetic with the revolutions of 1848.
48.
And he took his medical degree at the Charles University in Prague, which was a very celebrated medical school, and was a free thinker. And I think practicing in his hometown, which was very, very Catholic and very conservative, was perhaps a bit uncomfortable, and so he decided, once the Civil War was over, to migrate to America, where he, having more money than most immigrants, bought a farm in Illinois and tried to farm and practice medicine. But he didn't know much about farming, and people said that Nebraska was a better place, that land was cheap and would be very valuable one day. So he bought a lot of western Nebraska land, which never made enough to pay the taxes because of grasshoppers and droughts and so forth and so on. But the family hung on to that land until the Great Depression, when my father finally sold it just for taxes. Anyway, my grandfather was then a free thinker without church connection in a town where most people were church people. My mother was a Vermonter. Her family had come to Papillion so that her father could buy cattle from all the West. She went to Arizona and Colorado and succeeded quite well in buying cattle and shipping it to the stockyards in Omaha.
His name was Hunt.
His name was Hunt, yes. Ebenezer Hunt, the old Yankee name.
Good.
My Vermont grandmother didn't like the heat and flatness of Nebraska, and she was a woman who knew what was what, and so they moved back to Vermont. And my mother, who stayed on marrying my father, spent many of her summers, or parts of them, in the old home place in Vermont, and took the children with her, so I had a Vermont background as well as a Nebraska background.
What was the town near the farm in Vermont?
Essex.
Essex.
Essex Junction, which is near Burlington. There was a trolley car from Essex Junction to Burlington, and going to Burlington and taking one of the Lake Champlain tourist steamboats to Crown Point and Fort Ticonderoga were great events, as well as climbing Mount Mansfield and Conwell's Hump and other peaks in the Green Mountains, which I began to do when I was about 10 years old with my Vermont cousins, and camping at Lake Champlain, where an uncle had a very nice summer camp. When I was in the sixth grade, my family moved to Omaha. And then I went to a public school in Omaha. Solomon.
You were saying you had one brother and one sister older than you.
I had an older brother who went to the University of Nebraska and became a doctor. In World War I, as a young medic who had finished his residence work in Brooklyn, New York Hospital, he joined the Army and saw service in the front in France, and had a very high honor. He was very modest about it, and I don't know just what it was, but it was a very coveted honor, because he went out when he didn't have to rescue
wounded
men who'd been shot down. And he stayed in the Army, and in the 1920s was in the Army in China, where he was a friend of where has he been? Vinegar Joe. And whom I met later in visiting them. I think it was at Fort Snelling or one of the other places where my brother was an officer. He was also in World War II, and came to an unhappy end in the Korean War. My sister became a businesswoman until she married. I taught in a girls' school, the secretarial subjects, and then married a doctor and lived in Nebraska until just recently when she died.
Merle. When you mentioned that you were at Essex Junction, that's very close to Fort Ethan Allen.
Yes.
Did you have much contact with Fort Ethan Allen?
We went to band concerts at Fort Ethan Allen. My grandmother liked very much to go to band concerts at Fort Ethan Allen. And my brother knew some of the officers there before he finally was inducted into the Army in World War I.
Did you have much of an opinion about the Army one way or the other from what you saw of it at Fort Ethan Allen?
No, I didn't have any very strong feelings about it.
One way or the other?
No. There were a good many Army officers' wives who came to a farm in Jericho, Vermont, where after my freshman year in college, I worked as a gardener. And I had the impression that these were a rather frivolous lot. card-playing, horseback-riding women who were the technically the guests of Dr. Allen. Dr. Allen had been a medical missionary in Korea, and he was very kind to me and invited me to the house when he was giving talks and slides on Korea. He became, he was a court physician to the emperor and his family, and played a very important part in the diplomacy between Korea, Japan, and the United States. And I was very interested when I to find out when I first became acquainted with Fred Harrington that Harrington had written a book on Dr. Allen, God Mammon in Japan and Korea.
I remember that.
And I always could kid Harrington. He had seen the papers, but I had known and worked for Dr. Allen. That was my chief connection with Fort Ethan Allen, the wives of officers who were spending a break, giving a break from the routine life of Fort Ethan Allen.
Those railroad trips must have been something.
They were very interesting because it was a three-day trip. And I loved, of course, the dining cars. And these were the first blacks that I ever saw in the dining cars because they weren't...
The porters and the waiters.
Blacks in Papillion. And while they were in Omaha, that was a little bit later after I was already edging toward high school.
And you were saying you traveled in the Pullmans.
Yes.
Cars.
Oh, yes. Yes, I don't think my mother would have gone if she'd had to sit out with these young children. It's quite an undertaking for her.
You were saying something before about your father and your mother, their difference in personalities.
Yes.
That I thought was interesting.
My father believed in and exemplified the work ethic, the tremendously hardworking. Tried to have business deals. He always failed. He was not a businessman. And my mother, on the other hand, had more of the joy of life and loved parties and good times and dancing and card playing. And she was a churchwoman. She was an Episcopalian. And I was baptized into that church at the age of 6 weeks, I believe. I don't remember the occasion. And I remained in the Episcopal Church until high school when I drifted away from it.
You mentioned that your father, when he went to Omaha, went into a different business. He left.
Yes, he became. He went. He was an officer in a Farmers Mutual Insurance Company. This involved adjusting claims and so forth. And he never was good at business. He never made any money. He worked very, very hard just to keep afloat. Always was in debt, it seemed. I was always hearing about having to meet payments that were due. I never knew what they were, but I was aware of the fact that he didn't have much money. He worked terribly hard.
Well, you mentioned he had a garden.
Yes, he was a gardener, and he was very good at gardening. He was very good at all things with his hands, carpentry, to do all these things.
Loved to hunt.
Yes, and he made a lovely hunt and went hunting with other men, duck hunting through the northern parts of Nebraska as well as around Papillion, and loved fishing and outdoors things. And I got something of that, not hunting. I was given a .22 rifle to practice targeting because my father thought every boy should know how to use a rifle. And I did that. But it didn't help me much. By the time I got into the SATC, after in my second year
at Harvard,
third year
at Harvard,
where I was very inept at keeping step and following the rules. I tried to keep step, but the corporal or sergeant, always felt that I was doing it on purpose, keeping out of step on purpose, which wasn't the case at all. So I was sworn at constantly, more than anyone else. And I remember that the academic part of this training, we were supposed to be training for officers, and it was obvious to me, and I think to everyone else, that I would never be an officer. However, there I was. We had military French, which I could do, and calculus, which I was not very good at, and what was called military tactics, and a great deal of drilling. I remember I disliked the bayonet drill, particularly. Often the sergeant in charge or the company commander, I guess the sergeants would simulate gutting the enemy, and he did it very vividly. I had a great revulsion against this kind of butchery. But anyway, I tried to do my best. And finally, the company commander bawled me out for something I had done and said, "Is there anything you can do?" He said, "You're obviously no good at this." He said, "Did you ever work in a haberdasher?" And I said, "No, no, sir, I've never worked in a haberdasher." But he said, "If you had, we could put you there." But he said, "You can't do it." He said, "Is there anything you can do at all?" I couldn't think of anything. Then I finally said, "Well, I do know how to type." And he said, "Why in hell didn't you say so?" I said, "I didn't think it would interest you." He said, "Well, I need somebody to keep the records." So I was then inducted into that. But I had to continue to do all the drill. This didn't excuse me from drill. I just did this on the side. And finally made out the, when the armistice finally came and we were to be dismissed, separated from the armed services, I made out the leave taking, the...
discharge?
The discharge, yes. I made out the discharge, and the company officer signed them. I did all the rest. So this was not a glorious success at all. And it was my only exposure to the military, except in visiting my brother at many military stations, mostly West Point and Fort Snelling, but also San Luis Obispo, where he built up from scratch the great Army-based hospital in World War II. I had no direct connections with the armed forces, which I was somewhat prejudiced against as a quasi-pacifist. I wasn't really a complete pacifist, or I would have been a conscientious objector in World War I, but I just didn't like the idea of war, and I didn't think it was entirely necessary, and I never accepted the propaganda for World War I. I always was very skeptical about the glorious cause of the Allies.
I was going to ask you about that. How impressed were you by Wilson?
No, I wasn't. And I felt that Wilson was a rhetorician, and I didn't, his idealism never appealed to me as being the real thing. I felt that there was something meretricious about it. I was sure that he believed in it, but it didn't carry weight with me. And I never accepted World War I ideologically. I thought it was a mistake. However, I wasn't strongly enough convinced to be a real pacifist. After the war, we were all interested in international organization, and I did some early writing on the history of the peace movement. Then, having written a couple of books on the peace movement, I decided I had to look at the other side. And I wrote a book on the roots of American loyalty, which I tried to get at the nationalistic dedication to country. And many people say that was my best book. I don't know. Several people speak of it still. And I think it was certainly a pioneer book. There was nothing on American nationalism at that time, certainly nothing on patriotism and loyalty in any scholarly sense. It was certainly a pioneer book. And I did that deliberately because I wanted to see what is the other side of pacifism.
That's a good
this
point.
Seemed to be this seemed to be the thing, the 4th of July orations and the glorification of our military heroes and their achievements and sacrifices and so forth and so on.
That really started a trend. That was the first that I can think of. You can think of books that came along later where people are sort of following that same theme or going into different aspects of it. I wanted you to talk also about, your father was a Democrat and your grandfather was a Democrat, I gather.
That's right.
And your father was very much a Bryanite. I think you said he was more the populist
side
of Bryan.
I think so.
So Teddy Roosevelt really wasn't overly popular in your household as you were
I did hear him in the campaign of 1912 in Omaha.
Ah.
And also Wilson, and I guess it must have been Debs. Because Taft didn't go on the circuit. But I know I heard three. I'm a little vague about this. I would have thought I would have a more vivid recollection of Debs if I heard him,
because I had a high school teacher who was a socialist. My teacher in debating, a man who introduced us to socialism. Particularly, I remember we had a debate on socialism, and I was chosen to represent the debating team in an interstate contest. I remember the subject. But I can't remember very vividly that talk. It would have been in the Omaha auditorium.
You mentioned also that you'd heard Bryan after the war.
Yes.
I wish you'd talk
just
about
before
that.
The 18th Amendment went into effect. It was the 18th Amendment. It was the Prohibition Amendment, yes.
Yeah.
Bryan talked at Harvard in New Lecture Hall on Prohibition very eloquently. And though the Harvard undergraduates were certainly very much opposed to Prohibition, as I was, yet we were enormously impressed by his oratory.
Hmm.
And I remember there was a standing ovation, which was somewhat unusual for Harvard undergraduates who regarded themselves as rather sophisticated. So I did hear him on that occasion. And my father had introduced him, I remember, in the campaign of 1896,
in
the festival, but that was before my time. So I never knew Bryan other than by reputation. When I was working on the peace movement, I decided that Bryan would be a good subject for a monograph. And Mrs. Bryan gave me permission to use the Bryan papers, which were then in the Library of Congress, but hadn't been cataloged and were in great disarray. So I got the impression of Bryan from the papers that he was a horribly sloppy man. But as she explained, often he didn't even have a secretary, except what secretarial help she gave him. She said it was sometimes much too much for her. She couldn't keep up with it. I had some pleasant correspondence with Mary Bryan, Mrs. Bryan, and I did meet his daughter, who had been our minister to Denmark.
I wanted to ask you also about... You mentioned that you'd seen the Buffalo Bill Wild West show.
Yes.
As a boy.
And I was, of course, very excited by this, as any boy would be. I wanted very much to get to western Nebraska to see the rodeo. We didn't have rodeo at that time in Omaha. And I knew about it. I never got out there to see it. But I always was interested in it. And one of my favorite ballets is the rodeo ballet. Which
yes, by Aaron Copeland. Aaron Copeland was the composer, Robbins, I think,
Robbins
is the
choreographer.
When you moved to Nebraska, you were in the sixth grade, and I gather you mentioned that you were sort of a loner and you didn't do much.
Yes, I was very much a loner.
Until you went to
high school. I wasn't good at baseball, and I wasn't really welcome on the baseball field because I was very inept and fouled things up for them, and never would help them win a game. I compensated for my deficiencies in sports by studying and reading, and this didn't make me very popular with my fellow students, who were extroverts and hardball boys. But in high school, I sort of found myself, because there was, I think, more tolerance for people of deviant manners and habits. And I was elected president of my class and was on very good terms with all the students, particularly with those of an ethnic background.
You mentioned that this was South High School.
This was South High School.
You mentioned the ethnic background.
Yes, because a great many of the kids in this high school came from Polish, Lithuanian, Slovakian families and had to drop out and get jobs after one or two years in high school. Only a few of them stayed with the class for graduation. And in the class, everyone who went to college at all went to the University of Nebraska, where my brother had gone, or to... one of the church-related small colleges in Nebraska. So that when one of my teachers of history suggested that I ought to go to Harvard, this was almost unheard of in this high school, which served the packing houses and stockyards that had ever gone to an Eastern Ivy League school. I took the Harvard entrance exams.
Before we go to Harvard, I wanted to talk some more about the school. You mentioned that you were in debating, and you also belonged to a social club.
Yes, we had a Greek letter fraternity, which had dances and parties, and I liked all of that very much, and didn't regard it as snobbish or snooty, though I'm sure some kids in the high school must have. And I was editor of the tutor, the literary school magazine, and fancied myself to be something of a writer, which wasn't true at all because I really didn't know how to write.
Mm.
I had to learn what I learned about writing after I'd gone to college.
Also, I wanted you to tell about your teacher in your freshman year.
Yes, I had a very interesting,
very impressive.
Young and very beautiful teacher by the name of Julia Bednar of Czech, Nebraska Czech background. And I had Greek and Roman history with her in the first year, and I remember her talking about the Greek military and the Greek warfare and the assemblies, and particularly the Acropolis, which she described so vividly. I assumed, of course, that she must have been there, and decided someday I would see it myself. I had her medieval and modern history as well. And then she dropped out of teaching in high school to be married, and I lost track of her. But many years later, actually about 15 years ago, more or less, I was getting an honorary degree at the University of Nebraska, and the marshal said, there's a little old lady who has come down from Omaha by bus just to see you, so step out, we'll hold up the procession, and you can speak to her. And she was indeed very little and very old. And she said, you may possibly remember me from South High School as Julia Bednar. And I said, of course, Miss Bednar, how could I ever forget? You taught us all about the Acropolis. And she smiled and said, well, you know, at that time I'd never seen the Acropolis, but I have seen it since twice, really. And I'm a mother, a grandmother, and a great-grandmother. But I still am interested in education. When I saw that you were getting an honorary degree, I decided I must come by bus and at least speak to you. So I said, well, I'm so happy about this because I want to tell you how much you meant to me. And I got my interest in history in those classes of Greek and Roman history, medieval and modern. And she smiled and said, I wish I'd like to believe that that was true. And I said, it really is. I've never been able to tell you because I didn't know where you were. And now I have a chance to. And we corresponded at Christmas time until her death. It was a very happy occasion, the best part of getting an honorary degree at the University of Nebraska.
Well, you mentioned that there you were a freshman in high school, and you were reading Plutarch's Lives.
Yes, I did. That was suggested by, she suggested Plutarch, and I read Plutarch. And I read other things at the library, too, but I can't remember just what they were. I did read some Latin classics in English in my junior and senior year when we were reading in Latin Cicero and De Senectute particularly and the Aeneid in senior.
You took 4 years of Latin?
I took 4 years of Latin. We had no Greek in that high school or I would have taken. I had 2 years of German from a gentleman who really didn't know how to speak German, so I didn't learn any conversation. I learned some grammar and some reading. That's the only formal German that so I didn't learn any conversation. I learned some grammar and some reading. That's the only formal German that I ever had.
Didn't you say that your grandfather
My
wanted
grandfather
you to
wanted the children to learn German, but that would have involved going to a Lutheran parochial school. He didn't have any objection to that, though he was a free thinker, but my mother saw no point in our learning German, so I never did. I had the 2 years in high school, and then in college, Harvard at that time required a reading knowledge in German and French, and I thought that with some brushing up I could maybe pass the German exam, but I had to start French from scratch, so I wasn't able to take any Greek. And my German I learned chiefly reading for the prelims for the PhD, and when I finally got to Vienna as a graduate student, I was living in a German pension, German-speaking pension, so that was my German.
Well, I was impressed that you also had 4 years of history.
This was unusual. In junior year, we had English history. I remember the textbook very well. It was by Edward Cheney, a distinguished historian at the University of Pennsylvania, who had a volume which could be used in high school. It was a small class, elective, and then in our senior year, history with Celia M. Chase, who became a friend of the family, and who had done her master's degree at the University of Chicago, and who introduced me to constitutional history, McLaughlin, and others who, with whom she had worked at Chicago. And she was a very good teacher and very interested in having me, when I expressed an interest perhaps in becoming a high school teacher of history, in going to Harvard, which she said was the best place in the country to study American history because of all of the historical surroundings, and also because she knew about Albert Bushnell Hart, who taught history. She didn't seem to know much about Channing or Turner. At least she didn't speak of them. She spoke a great deal about Hart. Having passed the... having sneaked into Harvard barely in their entrance examinations, I chose as my advisor in my freshman year Albert Bushnell Hart, much bewhiskered, who was pleasant but distant, and who later I came to know somewhat because I took a course on the history of federal theory in the first year of graduate work. That's when we were all very much interested in the League of Nations. And I think I have told you this joke, that he would come into class with great bundles of manila folders where he kept his notes, including parts of books that he had cut out and put into these, including a very valuable 17th century book that Mr. Harold Laskett lent him. And I remember we came to the point where it was time, he thought, for us to be introduced to the history of federal theory in Latin America. And he said, this is a very important subject, gentlemen, pawing over his folders once and then having to do it a second time because he didn't find the folder. And with slight embarrassment, looking over his spectacles, said, gentlemen, there is no federal theory in Latin America. His course, I also took a semester course on Abraham Lincoln and the Civil War, which is the poorest course I ever took.
Why was it so poor?
Well, it was very thin, anecdotal, sentimental. It was a farce, and Harvard should have been ashamed of having given credit for such a course. But Hart had a reputation as an editor, and he was a politician, an academic politician. And I'm sure was not taken very seriously by his colleagues. But there he was, and Harvard having tenure, there was nothing to do about it.
Did you have much trouble adjusting to Harvard?
As a high school boy who had an easy time in coming to be with Lewis Wirth at the top of the class. Lewis Wirth later became a very distinguished sociologist at the University of Chicago. Having no problem in making the top, I really never learned how to study or how to write examinations. And I started off very badly with a D minus, I think, in history in the first 6 weeks, and certainly no more than a D in English, which I fancied myself to be quite good at. Whereas the boys who'd been to prep school knew how to take examinations and knew how to write papers, and were able to get gentlemen C's with a minimum of work while they pursued their various extracurricular pursuits. I had to work terribly hard as a student from Middle Western High School, and not a first-class high school at that, I think. I had a scholarship for which I had...
You mentioned those jobs.
I had two jobs that were part of the... packet. I had a job as a monitor in a large lecture class where I sat at the back of the lecture room with the chart. I had to report absences each day. Students were required attendance. And I remember the football men in the class very big, very well prepared from their prep school days, often demanded that I overlook their absence. This is quite a conflict because I wanted to be a good fellow and I wanted to show you that I was sympathetic with them. On the other hand, my conscience told me that as a scholarship student, I ought to obey the laws of the university. I don't remember what I did. I think I compromised between the two and sometimes overlooked the absences and sometimes at peril as far as my relations with them were concerned, noted them down. The other job was running an adding machine for a professor of education who was doing some kind of research, never explained to me. I'm sure I made a great many mistakes on the adding machine, but his teaching assistant or research assistant said, never mind, he doesn't really know quite what he's doing himself, so there's no great harm done. So my conscience was satisfied. After that, I had scholarships and that didn't require any return in services.
You mentioned Harold Laski. I was very
I think in my junior year, I had his course in English history, 19th century English history. It was very good. It was a brilliant lecture. Very good at repartee and anecdotes of famous people they need known, but it was subsequently also very good. I also had in my senior year his course on the history of political theory, which was very good. And I got acquainted with him by going to his some of his Sunday afternoons for undergraduate students, where he had often very interesting guests from Great Britain, and where he was very very relaxed and delightfully witty and pleasant. So I came to know him fairly well, saw him in later years at London when he was at the London School of Economics.
I gather this was unusual for the professors to have this sort of social...
Yes, most of them maintained a distance. You really didn't know your professors. Even in the graduate school, you really didn't know them very well outside of class. Though Turner did invite me when I was in his seminar for Thanksgiving dinner, and on other occasions was very kind. But in general, undergraduates at Harvard didn't know their instructors.
Did you have Turner as an undergraduate?
Yes, I had him in my junior year, which was broken by the SATC.
The war.
I had him in the second, after the war was over. From
spring of 1919.
Second, yes. And this was his famous History of the West course. I was completely entranced by it. I found it immensely stimulating and interesting. It was given largely in terms of explanation of maps, as I remember. He taught largely from his maps. These maps plotted the congressional elections and related the political voting to ethnic background and to location. And he was a pioneer in this kind of work. It sometimes has been forgotten that he was the pioneer in this sort of work. Now it's done commonly without any recognition of the fact that it was Turner who really first started this kind of correlation between voting behavior, background, place, ethnic, and so other considerations.
Was he very good as an undergraduate? Good lecturer?
He made no effort to appeal to undergraduates by telling Wild West stories. There was none of that. It was down to earth, straightforward, very substantive. You either took it or didn't. I liked it very much. We wrote term papers. These were considered very important. He read them himself. And I remember the comments that I had on them, and I think I had one conference with him, which was very good for an undergraduate to have. This was not a large course. It was relatively small in contrast with Professor Channing's introductory course to American history, which was a very large course, and in which he entertained the undergraduates by many anecdotes and stories, and as a good Yankee blue-blood Bostonian Brahmin of the Channing family, denigrated the West and the South, and tried to convert us to the belief that New England was the only part of the country that really counted. Of course, he didn't really believe that, but this was a part of his act. He took great delight in teasing everyone from the Middle West for calling professors when the Harvard custom was only to refer to them as Mr., which was considered the proper way of addressing them. He took me once to task for calling him professor, addressed me down quite properly, and I never did it again.
I wanted to ask you about it. Apparently, he hadn't traveled that much in the country until...
No, he hadn't been anywhere except New England. Finally, he did go to Charleston and made a great point of that, and also to California to see the Larkin papers when he was going to write about the acquisition of California for the Mexican War. He stayed only a few days, and he said that he saw all of California that he needed to, didn't need to see any more. So he was he played up his alleged provinciality. Actually, in his books, he did much more than that. Though he always felt that Turner greatly overemphasized the importance of the West, and that it was the Eastern Seaboard that really shaped the nation's destiny. In the seminar, which I took with him in graduate work, he always was working on the volume, which would be the next one that he would publish.
For the Great History.
So we were working on the 1850s, the year I took it. And I spent the year working on Virginia and North Carolina in the 1950s, I think, reading Virginia newspapers at Harvard and at the Athenaeum. And on one occasion at the Antiquarian Society in Worcester, which had some of the Virginia papers that were not available.
But that was an interesting experience. There, I don't think there's anything that gets you into a period.
As a reading the newspaper.
That's right.
Right. And we did that in his seminar.
You mentioned as an undergraduate that there was a map question.
Oh, yes, in his course. He was always talking about Trans-Appalachia, by which he meant everything west of the Appalachian Mountains. And I remember on the map question in the first 6 weeks, the question was, indicate on the map Trans-Appalachia. Was a very simple question. But I, in a spirit of joking, wrote down for Trans-Appalachia the area between the Atlantic seacoast and the Appalachian Mountains. And his teaching assistant didn't at first realize that this was a joke and asked me about it, and I said, well, you know, this is just a joke because Professor Channing has always talked about Trans-Appalachia. I decided Trans-Appalachia could just as well be the eastern seaboard to the mountains as it could be the mountains to the Pacific coast. And I said, well, he said, Professor Channing will be very interested in this, and he said, I'll tell him about it. So then Channing asked to talk with me about this Middle Westerner who took such liberties with his conception of the proper geography of the country. I learned that you had to tease Professor Channing, as he was a great teaser himself. But once you learned how to take his teasing, he could be quite delightful.
He at that time, though, he was a little taken aback.
Oh, yes, he was a little taken aback.
In fact, I
had this kind of a game with him.
That's right. The trouble with Midwesterners, they were hurting Harvard
by insisting on calling faculty professor. And otherwise corrupting the place.
I think you also mentioned that you thought that by and large the notes you'd taken in his course were rather thin. In Channing's course, lecture course.
Well, his lectures were interesting, but I think rather superficial in contrast with Turner's, which were very substantive and which took history with a great degree of seriousness.
I wanted to ask you, too. I gather in high school you read a good many novels, and they were, I think you mentioned Eliot and Hawthorne and Henty.
In high school I was a great reader, and I continued to be in college so far as I had time to do it. And I did do a great deal of reading in American literature, which at that time was not a well-recognized field. There was only one course given in American literature. I took that.
Who taught that?
That was given by a man named Greenough. This was before the days of, long before the days of Perry Miller and Howard Munford Jones, who came after, long after I graduated from Harvard.
It's the others.
It doesn't seem to be blinking.
Well, it should be.
Did you have Professor Haskins as an undergraduate?
Yes, I had him. He gave the whole first part of the introductory course in European history in my freshman year, and then I didn't have that until my first year of graduate work, when I took a new course that was given for the first time called Medieval Culture, the Intellectual History.
Gentlemen, and I'm talking with Merle Curdy on May 13th, 1982. Merle, I wanted to ask you about your visits to your brother, who was an Army doctor in the 20s and 30s. You mentioned the other day you visited him at various posts, I think at Fort Snelling and West Point. Places like that. Would you comment on your impressions of the peacetime Army as you saw it on those visits?
Well, I wondered what they were really doing, because it seemed to me they all had plenty of time. This was not quite the case with my brother, because as a medical officer, there were always people or wives who were getting sick or wanting something done. And he took his medical work very seriously, keeping up with his specialty, internal medicine, and going to clinics. When he was at West Point, he would go down to clinics at the Presbyterian Columbia Medical Center. He was very eager to give the best, and I know he was very conscientious. But I had the feeling that the officers in general didn't really have a great deal to do. They seemed to have quite a lot of time on their hands. There was a great deal of social life, of course. This was particularly true of the wives, who did lots of bridge and so on, and parties and dinners. And I remember at West Point, my brother and his wife had a maid, a full-time maid, a live-in maid. But they also had a lot of work done by a stoker.
Striker.
Huh?
A striker.
A striker, yes. He did all kinds of things for them, which were certainly way out of the line of any military.
This was in the 30s.
Yes, this was in the 30s. And then when the war came, of course, this was a very different thing. I can only say that these were pleasant experiences socially. I met various people, including people of the general's rank. My brother at that time was a colonel. And
his name was Ralph
Curdy,
wasn't
it? And well, I didn't think too much about it, but I remember that my younger daughter visiting West Point was taken to the parade ground, and she asked her uncle, said, "Is this a place where they learn how to kill people?" Reflecting, I suppose, something that I must have said to her, I don't remember. But I remember in her childish innocence, she said, "Is this where they practice how to kill each other?" I thought, well, out of the mouths of babes and suckers, we shall learn.
Yeah, I think you mentioned that you'd met General Stillwell,
yes.
Senator Joe Stillwell.
And later I saw a good deal of his widow after my brother had died, and my sister-in-law bought a house at Carmel. And Mrs. Stillwell was living in Carmel, so they were very close friends.
Winifred, I think her name was.
They were very close friends.
I got a questionnaire back from their daughter about her life.
Yes, I remember meeting their daughter.
I think her name's Winifred,
too.
Well, I just wanted to get that in because it aroused my curiosity the other day. When we left off the tape the other day, you were just starting to talk about Mr. Haskins and his interest in medieval intellectual history.
In my first year of graduate work, Haskins offered a new course, the intellectual history of the Middle Ages. It was a wonderful course because he had to give us the results of his long-sustained research on the reception of Arabic learning, mathematics, science, medicine, and so on. He hadn't yet published his famous 12th century Renaissance, but that was to come. So we had the advantage of a great deal of new material. We read Taylor's Medieval Mind, a big volume and two volumes, and a great deal of supplementary material. And I remember writing a long-term paper on the Chronicles of Froissart as documentary evidence of one aspect of the medieval mind. And one day I got up my courage to speak to Haskins, who was also dean of the graduate school, but I hadn't known him. And I said, "I know you started out in American history and got a PhD at Hopkins with Herbert Baxter Adams when you were very young, 21, I believe, the rumor had it." And he said, "Yes, that was right." And I said, "Well, of course, our American experience is much briefer than the long span of the Middle Ages, and obviously much of our intellectual life was a derivative of that of Europe. And I know it doesn't compare, it wouldn't compare in any way with the richness of intellectual life in the Middle Ages. But I'm wondering whether you would think I was completely crazy to say that I would like someday to work up a course on American intellectual history and do in a very, very small way what you've done so magnificently in the Middle Ages. And instead of brushing me off as a brash young graduate student, I said, that's a very good idea. He said, I think no one really has explored that. And he encouraged me very much. Then he said, if you do this, you've got to know a lot about Europe and the agencies and institutions of intellectual life in Europe, because these were transferred in greater or less degree to America. And America has derived so much in terms of ideas and thought and political theories from Europe that you need to have a first-hand experience with Europe. And I said, well, that would be impossible, because I would have to get a teaching job even to finish my PhD, and therefore I wouldn't be able to afford it. And he said, well, why don't you apply for a Sheldon Traveling Fellowship? And I said, well, my understanding, Mr. Haskins, is that these are reserved for students of European history who have to use the European archives. He said, well, it's true we haven't had any American historians go, but why don't you apply for one anyway? Now, this was a wonderful opening, because I knew his influence in the graduate school would be very great. And sure enough, I got one. And he and Archibald Coolidge, who was the librarian and the only man in East Asia that Harvard had at that time, gave me letters of introduction to various people, including, from Haskins, a letter of introduction to Charles Sestre, C-E-S-T-R-E, who, Haskins said, took American literature far more seriously than any American scholar did. It was at a time when American literature was considered simply a derivative branch of European, of English literature, and rather thin and not very important at all anyway. In the one course I'd had in American literature, the professor, who was a scholar in English literature, 18th century, did a good deal with the Puritans, but very, very little with the great 19th century writers. He had, of course, to discuss Emerson and Hawthorne, but he dismissed Melville as a writer of sea stories for boys that didn't amount to much. And Emily Dickinson wasn't even mentioned, and Mark Twain was beneath contempt, contempt as a humorous writer for boys not to be taken seriously.
This is Greenough.
Yes. So I knew there was a great deal more to American literature than this, but no graduate work was given in it. This is an introductory course, undergraduate. So Haskins said, at the Sorbonne, you will find that Charles Sess gives lectures on different aspects of American literature. I'll give you a letter to him. And he did, and Sess was very kind. I followed his course. The first term at the Sorbonne was the West in American literature. And I fitted in with what Turner was interested in, but didn't know too much about. And
did Sess know about Turner?
No, he didn't seem to know about him, but Haskins did. And the second term, Sess lectured on the New England poet E.A. Robinson. So each term he would take up something different. And I gave my a long manuscript, about 600 pages, that I had written as the beginnings of the rough sketch of a PhD dissertation, which I called The Development of American Consciousness. This was a vast subject, much too big for a dissertation. But Turner encouraged me to experiment, and he said, American nationalism is a subject we need to know about, and you can go at it from the point of view of cultural and intellectual history. So he encouraged me and thought this was fairly good, and I gave it to Sess. And Sess said, if you translate this into French, you can have a soutenance here, an examination, and you can get the doctorate of university degree. And I wrote to Haskins about that, and Haskins said, no, you better not do it. He said, the Harvard degree is worth much more than a Sorbonne degree if you're going to teach in America. And it would not be suitable to have two PhDs. It would seem to reflect on either one institution or the other. So he said, just forget that idea that Mr. Sest has suggested, and present your work when you get it ready at Harvard. Well, to finish that story, Turner was retiring. And he said it would be better for me to have this approved by his successor, not really Frederick Merck, who took over the course in Western history, but by Arthur M. Schlesinger Sr., who was coming on from Iowa, who was interested in social history, and to some extent in intellectual history. And Turner said, just have him read the manuscript, and I think he'll be very much interested in this. I've been. I had been in Europe then for 15 months in the summer, and when I came back, I had a job at Smith College.
Did you stay in Paris?
No. No, I traveled around. The first summer was just all travel, and the second summer was all travel because my fiance came over. She was a young teacher at Smith College in psychology. She came over. We were married in Paris in a civil ceremony, and we spent the summer touring around, sightseeing. I'd done some of the things before, but it was nice to do them again. We did some climbing in the French Alps, in the Dolomites, in Italy and Austria. And I did some, I'd already done some work in the Haushofer-Staat Archiven in Vienna on a term paper I'd written in a course on European history since 1815, in which William Langer, later a very distinguished European historian, had been the teaching assistant. And I had written a paper on America and the revolutions of 1848, and he encouraged me to go on with that. And I got rather fed up on just hearing lectures at the Sorbonne and visiting libraries and art galleries and going to such theaters as I could do. So I decided it might be fun to go to Vienna and try my hand at a little research in archives. I'd never done any archival research, which I did, and it was a very interesting experience. And I found that the reports of the Austrian minister in Washington were full of material on the American reactions to the revolutions of 1848, which had just then been crushed with the crushing of Kossuth's Hungarian rebellion by intervention of Russia and Prussia. And the American intervention movement, or Young America, had also more or less died out, but it was taken very seriously by the Chevalier de Hülsemann, who was the Austrian minister, and he reported to Count Schwarzenberg, the Minister of Foreign Affairs, and Schwarzenberg had a spy system in America under the auspices of Hülsemann. So the material was very good, and out of that I made my first publication, Austria in the United States, 1848 to 1852, which was published in the Smith College Studies, and part of which had been in this dissertation, that is the Young America part of it. Well, Schlesinger read the manuscript and said, I'm sorry to tell you that I can't accept this. He said, it is not a PhD dissertation at all. He said, what you've got is a series of essays on American self-consciousness, as you call it, but he said, you have exhausted nothing. It's just surface work. And what you have to do to get a PhD, if you want me to be your advisor and sponsor, is to do a very thorough study of some small segment or something. And I said, well, do you think there's anything here that would lend itself to that? And he said, well, think it over. And I said, you go read it again yourself and come up with a suggestion, and I'll show you what I think of it. So I read it over, and I saw that I had 4 pages of the 600 pages on the early American peace movement, about which no one had written anything. So I wrote to him and said, would it be acceptable to write a thorough investigation of the early American peace movement, which nobody seems to have written on at all. There seems to be nothing on it. And he said, yes, that would be very good. It would be a good subject. Go ahead. So I really wrote that dissertation. I did the research and wrote it completely on my own. I think I had maybe one conference, but I don't think so. I think I just wrote an occasional letter to Mr. Schlesinger indicating that I had discovered the William Ladd papers and what. Go ahead. So I really wrote that dissertation. I did the research and wrote it completely on my own. I think I had maybe one conference, but I don't think so. I think I just wrote an occasional letter to Mr. Schlesinger indicating that I had discovered the William Ladd papers in Washington, that I discovered the Elihu Burritt papers in Britain, Connecticut, and that I was going on. Well, I was teaching full-time at Smith College, And my seniors were very nice when I explained to them that instead of almost having a PhD, which I had told them when I was getting the job, alas, my dissertation that I thought was a dissertation wasn't acceptable, and I was having to do one from scratch. Well, this was John Spencer Bassett, who worked in recent history, but also had edited the Jackson Papers and written the life of Jackson, and Sidney B. Fay, who was already very well known for his work on revisionism of World War I. They were very nice, and they said, don't worry about your job. It was an assistant professor at $1,800 a year. Don't worry about it. Just go ahead and do your research and write your thesis and in such spare time as you could. Such time as you could spare from your classes, when they don't neglect them, because we attach a great importance to teaching, as Smith at college certainly did. So I did all of the research that year, and in the summer, then wrote it up the next year, sent it down to Schlesinger, and he wrote back within 2 weeks and said this was very acceptable and come down any time that was convenient for me, and they would arrange an oral examination, not only on the dissertation, but on my whole special field, which according to the Harvard system, you weren't examined on until you presented your dissertation. So that was my experience. Coming out of the conference, the conversation with Dean Haskins, then was my determination, when I got a job and got my bearings, to ask whether I could give a course on American intellectual history. And after I had been at Smith 2 or 3 years and knew my colleagues, including a very good friend that I've made, my the other man in American history was Harold U. Faulkner.
Economic historian.
We were next door neighbors and very close friends. And he encouraged me to, he was older than I, and he suggested that he would support me. And so I spoke to John Spencer Bassett, and he had edited some of the William Byrd papers, and thus I had some inkling of what intellectual history might be, though no one used the title of the word, no one used the term. And with his support and that of Faulkner, the department said I could give this course, which I did. And I think it was either the first or one of the first courses.
When was this? Do you remember?
1928, I think.
28.
Then it wasn't until long after that that Howard Munford Jones came to Harvard and developed the history and literature program, and that Perry Miller then came and developed his great work in the Northern Mind.
Did you use a textbook, or did you just have readings?
To read.
I was wondering what you would use.
No, there wasn't. It didn't exist. There was none. No, I just had them do readings. And I worked on the bibliography. I had them read some of Cotton Mather, and I had them read some of Jonathan Edwards. These were not available in reprints or paperbacks, but the library had at least one copy, and the Forbes Library in Northampton had a second copy of most of these things, a very good library. And that was it. The class was not too big at first. It was very small. It grew. So that then the problem of readings became important, because this was the day before microfilm and paperbacks and so on. In fact, I once suggested to Alfred Knopf that he ought to publish some paperbacks as France and the European countries did. He said it would be impossible in America. He couldn't do it. And sooner or later, it was published and discovered that paperbacks were a big thing and you could do it. That was Alfred Knopf's original reaction when I suggested to him. He was a friend of my colleague in sociology, Harry Elmer Barnes. And it was at Barnes's house that I met people like Alfred Knopf, who's a friend of Barnes, and people like Mencken. H.L. Mencken was a great friend, came to visit Barnes in Northampton. And
was Mencken as acerbic in his
yes,
social?
I just was there for one evening, you know, so I really couldn't say I knew him, but I met him. Yes, he was. And kind of a show off, I thought, that night at least. Sort of showing the other members of the faculty who were Barnes's friends or proteges what he could do in the way of performance. So anyway, that was how I got started in intellectual history, and I really think that I was one of the first to do it. Related to that was my idea of presenting American literature as one of the six fields that Harvard required for the PhD. In those days, you took a written examination, a very long one. I guess it was 2 days. I can't remember. but there were six fields in all, and you wrote on five fields for your prelims, or as they called them, generals. And I had the Renaissance and Reformation, the English constitutional history, the history of political theory from the Greeks on, and Russian history, which was very interesting, coming down to 1917. We read the great classics in English that Khrushchev had been translated, not Khrushchev, but I can't quite think. One of the great... still read. There was also an economic history by a Canadian historian, which had been translated. We also read German and French works on Russian history. I didn't read Russian, of course. So then, for the sixth field, then one field was to be American and colonial history. That was the fifth field. Then there was the special field, which was the 19th century, American history of the 19th century. And you were examined on that when you presented. There were only 20 years in the 20th century at this time, so these didn't count. This was considered current events or something. So the history department considered my request to present as my other field, American literature. And by this time, Greenough wasn't teaching it at all. Liz Perry, who had been the editor of the Atlantic Monthly, and who'd been brought in by President Lowell to encourage to give a course which would make the undergraduates really like literature. And he was a great teacher, and he succeeded in that, but he was not a scholar in the technical sense. But he did have an interest in American literature, and I've taken a reading course with him, where we read American texts. So the history department then understand where he said American literature is not a sufficiently important field to be counted as a field for the PhD, but if you will supplement it and call the field American History and Thought, we will accept that as a field. Well, nobody knew what the history of American thought was. It didn't exist in any literature or historiography. But I read what I could, and so I came up for the examination in these five fields, which had already been examined on in writing. But now there was the oral examination. And they asked Liz Perry to come to be the one to examine me on American literature. And he began by saying, "Well, gentlemen, this is the first occasion I've ever had to examine anyone in American literature. I really don't," and thought, he said, "I really don't know where to begin with this thought business." But he said, "I think we might take a stab and ask the candidate to say what relationships he sees, if any, between Mary Baker G. Eddy, the Puritans, and the Transcendentalists." Well, that was a very good question. I never thought of Mary Baker G. Eddy as being an important thought of American thought. I realized, of course, that she was, and I knew enough about science and health to be able to make a stab at it. And then we got on very nicely. And
who were your other professors in those fields?
Well, there was McIlwain in English history, constitutional history, who was an excellent scholar. There, Lasky in the history of political theory, as I remember it. I'd taken his course. McIlwain also succeeded Lasky in that field. And I had listened, I think it was Lasky. And for early American history, Morrison. And for Russian history, it was Professor Lord, who later became a Roman Catholic priest after his conversion. And in the Renaissance and Reformation, it was Professor Merrim, who was a specialist in that field, and particularly in the Spanish part of the Renaissance. So that was my, and these were
Morrison
real workout. The examination was a very serious affair. I entered that room in fear and trembling, because I knew how little I knew and how much I was expected to know in five fields as different. That's Russian history, English history, the Renaissance and Reformation, and only one in American history, colonial history, and which was supposed to be my American is supposed to be my research. When I came down from my final examination, the committee was Schlesinger, Merck, and a visiting professor, C.K. Webster from either Oxford or London, and who had read my dissertation and who asked whether the peace movement hadn't set back the cause of peace more than it contributed to it.
That's an interesting
other questions. But that examination was much easier than the original one.
How did
they had already decided that this was an acceptable dissertation. But Merck asked me some questions that I couldn't answer. I remember, to my shame, he wanted to know how wheat in 1850 would get from Wisconsin to New York. And I could only think of the Erie Canal. I knew that if it could get to Buffalo, I couldn't remember what canals there were, what railroads had been built. He said, was there a railroad that would take wheat from western Wisconsin to Milwaukee? And I didn't know whether there was or not. Actually, there was one in 1857, one of them, but not in 1850. I didn't know that at the time. I thought probably there was a railroad. But anyway, it was a pleasant experience after my having to write two dissertations. I used to tell my PhD candidates that I thought I was unique in having written two PhD dissertations, one with Turner, which was not acceptable by his successor, and one with Mr. Schlesinger, which I had done all on my own, except that he had approved of it in the end. And therefore, they shouldn't fret about doing one dissertation if I had done two to get a degree. So anyway, it's an interesting part of academic history. And I was telling it once to our colleague, Bill Taylor. Bill said, well, when the history department said that you could present a field with American literature and thought, that was the beginning, academically speaking, of American intellectual history. And they decided that you could do that. He said that was the beginning of the new discipline. And they decided you could do this. Well, I was there sort of
at the beginning.
At the beginning.
Well, in your graduate program at Harvard, was there a mixture of lecture classes and seminars?
At Harvard, in my day, I don't know how it is now, but in my day, there were lecture courses which were open to both graduates and majors in the field, people who were concentrating in the field and upperclassmen. And that was true of the Renaissance and Reformation. I'd had a good many of these courses as an undergraduate, so I didn't have to take as many as normally one would, but I had to take Russian history, and I hadn't had English constitutional history. I hadn't had the Renaissance and Reformation, so I had those courses. They were lecture courses, but also the great emphasis was put on the term papers. And these were not just a slight affair, but they had to be research papers. You had to use primary documents. So this was the graduate part of it. Then there were the seminars. And I had a seminar with a man not well known, who later went to Reed College. But it was a very good seminar. I learned more than I did in Turner's seminar, really, about the techniques of research. It was Rex Aragon, who was interested in Latin American history and the relations between the United States and Latin America. And this was a seminar on diplomatic relations between Latin America and the United States in the 19th century. And there we used government documents, and we had learned a lot about bibliography, and we read Langlois and Seignobos on historical method. And it was an excellent training, which was the only thing of that kind that I got.
Now, how did he spell his name?
A-R-R-A-G-O-N. And he was a very good teacher. We later became friends when he was at Reed College. In fact, when I was at Smith, he invited me out to take a job at Reed College, but I didn't want to do that.
Well, how did Mr. Turner run a seminar?
We didn't read any of the manuals on historical method, such as Langlois and Seignobos, which was then the principal and acceptable. The Dahlmann Weitzmann in German, which Haskins had all of his graduate students read in his seminar at least. Turner just assumed that his own example was enough to get us going. And he emphasized the importance of government documents and newspapers. He was a great believer in the importance of newspapers and the writings of frontier people, travel literature, and reminiscences of pioneers and settlers. and anything about land companies that, in the way of primary materials. So we were...
Paul Gates has really picked up on that
Paul
part.
Paul picked up on that. Paul Gates was one of Brick's students, so he's a little bit younger.
He's a little bit later.
One later, but Turner, Merck really got his idea about that from him. Also, this course of Turner's and the seminar included American immigration to the West. Marcus Hansen was one of my fellow students.
He was
one of Turner's PhDs. He finished before I did, so I think I was the last of Turner's PhD students. But there were very good people. There was Jim Hedges, who later was at Brown University and wrote a very important biography of the Brown brothers and economic history of Rhode Island. He didn't go on with the West, though he did a dissertation on some aspect of the history of the West. But after he got to Brown, he used the Brown papers for the writing of the development of the industrial and business aspects of the Brown brothers. And there was Howard K. Beale.
Oh, he was in Turner's seminar.
Not the year I was in it.
Ah.
He was in it the next year, but he was in the graduate school, so I knew him. And there was Paul Buck.
Yes.
Who later became the provost of Harvard.
Yes.
And who wrote his dissertation with Schlesinger later.
Was his dissertation Road to Reunion? Was
yes.
That his dissertation?
That was done with Schlesinger. That is, Paul didn't finish his PhD with Turner, but he was in Turner's seminar. I don't know what he did, but I knew him very well. We were close friends. So that there were very good graduate students, and all of them were heard from later. Some of them became very well known.
What sort of personality did Turner have?
He was
How was he in person?
Very soft-spoken. Gentle in his way of dealing with people. He's a great out-of-doors man, a great fisherman. He used to always go to either Maine or Canada for trout fishing. And he and Miss Perry used to go fishing together in Quebec. He also he was interested in the theater and music, but primarily, he was a scholar, and as Billington indicates in his very interesting biography, he was very much a man's man in the sense that he really didn't care for the social life, which many academic people at Harvard did, I think. He was very devoted to his students. He took his undergraduates in their stride, as he didn't. As I indicated, the other make an effort to interest them. If they were interested, fine. If they weren't, he didn't try to play up to them by telling them interesting stories or anecdotes about the West, Indians and cowboys, and none of that. It was straightforward, down-to-earth, largely exposition of maps and documents, even in his lecture course. The lecture course was tantamount to graduate level, though some undergraduates did get in there in one way or another, not quite knowing what they were getting into, expecting, I think, a Wild West show or something of the kind. So Turner was very devoted to his graduate students. He took us almost as younger colleagues. He expected that we were going to do very well, and his expectation made us for our best effort. We didn't want to, we loved him, and we didn't want to disappoint him. So we really went all out to do our very best. This assumption that, of course, we were going to all be very well-known historians was very flattering, but also it was very challenging, very stimulating. And it was a very interesting, I think it came very natural to him. He didn't do it as a technique, it just, he thought of us as younger colleagues. And he always said he learned as much from us as we could have learned from him. And I know he believed that. It wasn't just so much, so many words. So Turner was a great teacher of graduate students, even though I don't think he gave us the kind of rigid methodological training that many people giving a seminar do. I tried to make up for that. I tried to do more with that when I was teaching at Edward School, when I began teaching at Columbia and here. But on the other hand, we learned how to make these maps, correlating all kinds of data with geography and plotting maps and curves and so forth. And we certainly had to use documents, but he just didn't seem to feel that it was necessary to teach us how to write. That would have been, to me, very helpful, because I really didn't know very well how to write. I had to learn it later.
Did he, when you turned in papers, did he
very elaborate
comments?
But these were more substantive in character.
Rather than the techniques of writing.
Technique of writing. No. He didn't do much with that. But he did do a great deal. And we always had a conference with our seminar papers. We had to do two seminar papers each semester. One was a substantive research report, what we had found in our own research. And the other one was what he called a problem paper, in which out of our larger paper, we had to isolate some kind of an historical problem and offer a solution for it the best we could. And he called that the problem paper. And that was very challenging, because, first of all, we hardly knew how to look for a problem, you know. We had to keep looking for what could you say was an historical problem. So it was very good in a sense. So his training, he gave us very good training, but it was not the characteristic out-of-the-book training. It was learning by doing, so to speak. And it worked, as his many productive graduate students over many years, I think, proved.
Well, did you have you mentioned that Morrison was on your committee. Did you have any courses with
yes,
him?
Yes, I had two courses with Sam Morrison. I became a kind of a protege, curiously, of Sam. I think I was probably the only Middle Western student he'd had that showed any great interest in New England, which I did partly because of my own New England background. He was almost a professional New Englander, like his teacher, Channing. He invited me, I remember once, I took a course in my senior year on colonial history. The first semester, colonial history, the second semester, the American Revolution. It was a very poor course in the sense of covering the ground. Hmm. He was interested in, at that time, in the Viking explorations of the New World. We spent the first 6 weeks of a course, which included undergraduates as well as first-year graduate students, on the question, did the Vikings make a landfall in what is now the Commonwealth of Massachusetts? Well, this involved not only reading the sagas, in translation, of course, but learning all we could about the flora and fauna of Massachusetts. We went, I remember, to the Bussey Institution, the botanical institution, to learn about all the flowers and vines and so forth that were mentioned in the sagas. We spent 6 weeks of a one-semester course on that. So you can imagine there wasn't a great deal of time for the 18th century. And so when I had at Smith to teach a course on the colonial history, except that I had read for my examination, and I had read some Osgood and Andrews, which were then the standard works in early American history. But I really didn't know much about it. I had to work. I'd never even heard of Evans' American Bibliography down to 1800. I ran on to that by accident. I was going through the stacks, and I found it in the Smith College Library. I didn't know it existed. So Sam Morrison gave a course to his own liking, and you got his flavor, and he was a very interesting man with a nice sense of irony and a good deal of wit, intellectual wit. And I was his guest for more than one weekend at Concord, where he was then living. I remember once he said, would you like to walk around Walden Pond? Or would I ever have been around Walden Pond? He didn't say a word all the time we were walking around the pond, and I didn't dare interfere because by saying something about it, maybe he's in some deep, profound thought. I don't want to interrupt. So then he said, I think we'll drop in to see the Mrs. Emerson. He said, they'll be having tea now. These were Ralph Waldo Emerson's own daughters. Very
really?
Lovely ladies.
Huh.
And they were always at home, apparently, for tea in the afternoons. Morrison was, as a Boston blue blood, one of their acquaintances or friends. We stopped in, and they were very polite to this Midwestern undergraduate student who professed a great interest in their father. They said, would you like to see the library? They showed me his books, which were then pretty much as he had left them. Their brother, Dr. Emerson, was editing the
The letters?
Emerson journals. Mm-hmm. No, not the letters. Those came much later. But he was editing the journals.
Mm.
I didn't meet him, but they told me about that. So that was a very interesting experience.
My goodness. That's a... When I was in college, I had a... my American Lit professor went to Concord after he was discharged from the Army in 1919, and he would always show us, as the punchline in his lecture, a pencil that supposedly had been made by Thoreau, when Thoreau, you know, made pencils, and he had bought this.
It could well have been.
It could have been. In 1919, he picked it up.
Could well have been.
Well, Morrison, I only saw him once or twice, and of course he was then Admiral Morrison, I was just trying to think of the word. Formidable is not exactly it.
Yes, I think one could say formidable. He would be formidable to most people unless you knew him, unless you had some...
I was in the Library of Congress, and he came in the manuscripts division, and of course everything was still, and people started running around, and he was talking in a normal tone and everything.
Well, I liked his first wife very much. She was a very lovely person. She was reared the Green family, a very wealthy, educated family in Boston. They've been merchants in their time. And she'd been brought up in Paris, so she spoke English with a slight French accent.
Hmm.
A lovely person. Later, I taught the eldest Morrison daughter at Smith. She was in one of my classes at Smith, and we came to know her quite well. And through her father, I did for life, because her father had been very kind to me as an undergraduate.
Hmm.
We did what we could for her. Their son, Peter, didn't turn out very well. He was a great disappointment, I think, to his father. But the daughter's married. I don't know what ultimately happened to the two. The second Mrs. Morrison was a Baltimore belle. I met her at the AHA when Morrison was president, but I never really knew her.
Mm.
By this time, Sam disapproved of me because I had written so much on the peace movement and was something of a pacifist. And he didn't really approve of that. And though he had a certain interest in left-wing liberalism when I knew him at Harvard, he'd become very conservative in his later years. However, I had a very nice note for him shortly before he died. The AHA was going to meet in Boston, and he wrote to me and said, I'm not very well, but I'm going to, I'm inviting a few people for tea, and I would like very much to have you come.
Hmm.
Well, I have decided not to go to that meeting, so I wrote back and said I was very sorry because I would love to have seen him. This was just shortly before he died.
Well, I know he was at the OAH, I think it was Philadelphia, just a few months before he died, because I didn't go, but some people told me they'd seen him there. His book, The Exploration of North America, had just come out.
It was amazing what he did in his later years. He was a gifted writer. Had a great sense of style in the Parkman tradition. Parkman was his great hero.
Mm.
I guess he did have a suite in that course, and Parkman, come to think of it, I guess he did have a suite in Parkman.
You know, Parkman's, what would you call it, his notebooks have just been published in paperback.
I didn't know that.
I was able to, I picked them up at a Marlborough store in New York 4 years ago.
I didn't know that. Wilbur Jacobs is at Santa Barbara, is doing a new study of Parkman. I had said, well, I would have thought the Doherty life did about everything one could do, but he said, no, there's a lot yet to be done. And I don't know just what he's doing, but I saw him last winter when I was in Santa Barbara.
I wanted to ask you, what are your techniques of working? Do you have certain times of the day that you would write, or,
no,
you know?
Just
whatever?
When I could seize the time. I have far more students here than I think any of you have now.
Yes, you do.
Because there are now several of you who do American history, and we don't have nearly as many graduate students as we did when there were jobs to be had. So, right after World War II, I had between 25 and 30 in my seminar.
Mm.
And, you know, this was a terrific job to read papers and correct them and have conferences with so many students. And I think at all, counting my Columbia PhDs, I had between 90 and 100. There's a lot of PhD dissertations too. So I didn't learn any conversation. I learned some grammar and some reading. That's the only formal German that I ever had.
Didn't you say that your grandfather
wanted the children to learn German, but that would have involved going to a Lutheran parochial school. He didn't have any objection to that, but he was a free thinker. But my mother saw no point in our learning German, so I never did. I had the 2 years in high school, and then in college, Harvard at that time required a reading knowledge in German and French. And I thought that with some brushing up, I could maybe pass the German exam, but I had to start French from scratch. So I wasn't able to take any Greek. And my German, I learned chiefly reading for the prelims for the PhD.
Mm.
And when I finally got to Vienna as a graduate student, I was living in a German pension, German-speaking pension, so that was my German.
Well, I was impressed that you also had 4 years of history.
This was unusual. In junior year, we had English history. I remember the textbook very well. It was by Edward Cheney, a distinguished historian at the University of Pennsylvania, who had a volume which could be used in high school. It was a small class, elective. And then in our senior year, history with Celia M. Chase, who became a friend of the family, and who had done her master's degree at the University of Chicago, and who introduced me to constitutional history, McLaughlin, and others with whom she had worked at Chicago. And she was a very good teacher and very interested in having me, when I expressed an interest perhaps in becoming a high school teacher of history, in going to Harvard, which she said was the best place in the country to study American history because of all the historical surroundings, and also because she knew about Albert Bushnell Hart, who taught history. She didn't seem to know much about Channing or Turner.
Hmm.
At least she didn't speak of them. She spoke a great deal about Hart. And having passed the... having sneaked into Harvard barely in their entrance examinations, I chose as my advisor in my freshman year, Albert Bushnell Hart, much bewhiskered, who was pleasant but distant, and who later I came to know somewhat because I took a course on the history of federal theory in the first year of graduate work. That's when we were all very much interested in the League of Nations. And I think I have told you this joke, that he would come into class with great bundles of manila folders where he kept his notes, including parts of books that he had cut out and put into these, including a very valuable 17th century book that Mr. Harold Laska had lent him. And I remember we came to the point where it was time, he thought, for us to be introduced to the history of federal theory in Latin America. And he said, this is a very important subject, gentlemen, pawing over his folders once and then having to do it a second time because he didn't find the folder. And with slight embarrassment, looking over his spectacles, said, gentlemen, there is no federal theory in Latin America. His course, I also took a semester course on Abraham Lincoln and the Civil War, which is the poorest course I ever took.
Hmm. Why was it so poor?
Well, it was very thin, anecdotal, sentimental. It was a farce.
Hmm.
And Harvard should have been ashamed of having given credit for such a course. But Hart had a reputation as an editor, and he was a politician, an academic politician. And I'm sure it was not taken very seriously by his colleagues. But there he was, and Harvard having tenure, nothing to do about it.
But did you have much trouble adjusting
yes,
to Harvard?
As a high school boy who had an easy time in coming to be with Lewis Wirth at the top of the class, Lewis Wirth later became a very distinguished sociologist at the University of Chicago. Having no problem in making the top, I really never learned how to study or how to write examinations. And I started off very badly with a D minus, I think, in history in the first 6 weeks, and certainly no more than a D in English, which I fancied myself to be quite good at. Whereas the boys who'd been to prep school knew how to take examinations and knew how to write papers and were able to get gentlemen C's with a minimum of work while they pursued their various extracurricular pursuits. I had to work terribly hard as a student from Middle Western High School, and not a first-class high school at that, I think. I had a scholarship for which I had...
You mentioned those jobs.
I had two jobs that were part of the packet. I had a job as a monitor in a large lecture class, where I sat at the back of the lecture room with the chart, and I had to report absences each day. Students were required attendance. And I remember the football men in the class, very big, very well prepared from their prep school days, often demanded that I overlook their absence. This is quite a conflict, because I wanted to be a good fellow and I wanted to show you that I was sympathetic with them. On the other hand, my conscience told me that as a scholarship student, I ought to obey the laws of the university. I don't remember what I did. I think I compromised between the two and sometimes overlooked the absences and sometimes at peril as far as my relations with them were concerned, noted them down. The other job was running an adding machine for a professor of education who was doing some kind of research, never explained to me. I'm sure I made a great many mistakes on the adding machine, but his teaching assistant or research assistant said, never mind, he doesn't really know quite what he's doing himself, so there's no great harm done. So my conscience was satisfied. After that, I had scholarships and that didn't require any return in services.
You mentioned Harold Laski. I was very
I think in my junior year, I had his course in English history, 19th century English history. It was very good. It was a brilliant lecture. Very good at repartee and anecdotes of famous people that he'd known, but it was subsequently also very good. I also had in my senior year his course on the history of political theory, which was very good. And I got acquainted with him by going to his some of the Sunday afternoons for undergraduate students, where he had often very interesting guests from Great Britain, and where he was very very relaxed and delightfully witty and pleasant. So I came to know him fairly well, saw him in later years at London when he was at the London School of Economics.
I gather this was unusual for the professors to have this sort
yes,
of social...
most of them maintained a distance. You really didn't know your professors. Even in the graduate school, you really didn't know them very well outside of class. Though Turner did invite me when I was in his seminar for Thanksgiving dinner, and on other occasions was very kind. But in general, undergraduates at Harvard didn't know their instructors.
Did you have Turner as an undergraduate?
Yes, I had him in my junior year, which was broken by the SATC.
The war.
I had him in the second, after the war was over. From
spring of 1919.
Second, yes. And this was his famous History of the West course. I was completely entranced by it. I found it immensely stimulating and interesting. It was given largely in terms of explanation of maps, as I remember. He taught largely from his maps. These maps plotted the congressional elections and related the political voting to ethnic background and to location. And he was a pioneer in this kind of work. It sometimes has been forgotten that he was the pioneer in this sort of work. Now it's done commonly without any recognition of the fact that it was Turner who really first started this kind of correlation between voting behavior, background, place, ethnic, and so forth. other considerations.
Was he very good as an undergraduate? Good
well,
lecturer?
He made no appeal. He made no effort to appeal to undergraduates by telling Wild West stories. Mm. There was none of that. It was down to earth, straightforward, very substantive. You either took it or didn't.
Hmm.
I liked it very much. We wrote term papers. These were considered very important. He read them himself.
Hmm.
And I remember the comments that I had on them, and I think I had one conference with him, which was very good for an undergraduate. Hmm. This was not a large course. It was relatively small in contrast with Professor Channing's introductory course to American history, which was a very large course,
hmm.
and in which he entertained the undergraduates by many anecdotes and stories, and as a good Yankee blue-blood Bostonian Brahmin of the Channing family,
mm.
denigrated the West and the South, and tried to convert us to the belief that New England was the only part of the country that really counted. Of course, he didn't really believe that, but this was a part of his act. He took great delight in teasing everyone from the Middle West for calling professors professors when the Harvard custom was only to refer to them as Mr., which was considered a proper way of addressing them. He took me once to task for calling him professor, who addressed me down quite properly, and I never did it again.
I wanted to ask you about it. Apparently he hadn't traveled that much in the country until...
No, he hadn't been anywhere except New England. Finally, he did go to Charleston and made a great point of that. And also to California to see the Larkin papers when he was going to write about the acquisition of California for the Mexican War. He stayed only a few days, and he said that he saw all of California that he needed to, didn't need to see any more. So he was he played up his alleged provinciality. Actually, in his books, he did much more than that. Though he always felt that Turner greatly overemphasized the importance of the West,
hmm.
and that it was the Eastern Seaboard that really shaped the nation's destiny. In the seminar, which I took with him in graduate work, he always was working on the volume, which would be the next one that he would publish.
For the Great History.
So we were working on the 1850s, the year I took it, and I spent the year working on Virginia and North Carolina in the 1950s, I think, reading Virginia newspapers at Harvard and at the Athenaeum, and on one occasion at the Antiquarian Society in Worcester, which had some of the Virginia papers that were not available.
That was an interesting experience. I don't think there's anything that gets you into a period.
As a reading the newspapers.
That's right.
Yes. Right. And we did that in his seminar.
You mentioned as an undergraduate that there was a map question.
Oh, yes, in his course. He was always talking about Transappalachia, by which he meant everything west of the Appalachian Mountains. And I remember on the map question in the first 6 weeks, the question was, indicate on the map Transappalachia. It was a very simple question. But I, in a spirit of joking, wrote down for Transappalachia the area between the Atlantic seacoast and the Appalachian Mountains. And his teaching assistant didn't at first realize that this was a joke and asked me about it, and I said, well, you know, this is just a joke because Professor Channing has always talked about Transappalachia. I decided Transappalachia could just as well be the eastern seaboard to the mountains as it could be the mountains to the Pacific coast. And I said, well, he said, Professor Channing will be very interested in this, and he said, I'll tell him about it. So then Channing asked to talk with me about this Middle Westerner who took such liberties with his conception of proper geography. I learned that you had to tease Professor Channing, as he was a great teaser himself. But once you learned how to take his teasing, he could be quite delightful.
He at that time, though, he was a little taken aback.
Oh, yes, he was a little taken aback.
In fact, I
have this kind of a game with him.
That's right. The trouble with Midwesterners, they were hurting Harvard or
right.
taking Harvard.
By insisting on calling faculty professor. and otherwise corrupting the place.
I think you also mentioned that you thought that by and large the notes you'd taken in his course were rather thin. In Channing's course.
Yes.
Lecture course.
Well, his lectures were interesting, but I think rather superficial.
Mm.
In contrast with Turner's, which were very substantive, and which took history with a great degree of seriousness.
I wanted to ask you, too. I gather in high school you read a good many novels, and they were...
Yes.
I think you mentioned Eliot and Hawthorne and Henty.
Yes, in high school I was a great reader, and I continued to be in college so far as I had time to do it. And I did do a great deal of reading in American literature, which at that time was not a well-recognized field. It was only one course given in American literature. I took that. And
who taught that?
That was given by a man named Greenough. This was before the days of, long before the days of Perry Miller. And Howard Munford Jones, who came after, long after I graduated from Harvard.
What's the others?
It doesn't seem to be thinking.
Well, it should be,
Did you have Professor Haskins as an undergraduate?
Yeah. Yes, I had him, he gave the whole first part of the introductory course in European history in my freshman year. And then I didn't have that until my first year of graduate work, when I took a new course, it was given for the first time, called Medieval Culture, the Intellectual History.
And I'm talking with Merle Curdy on May 13th, 1982. Merle, I wanted to ask you about your visits to your brother, who was an Army doctor in the 20s and 30s. You mentioned the other day you visited him at various posts, I think at Fort Snelling and West Point and places like that. Would you comment on your impressions of the peacetime Army as you saw it on those visits?
Well, I wondered what they were really doing, because it seemed to me they all had plenty of time. This was not quite the case with my brother, because as a medical officer, there were always people or wives who were getting sick or wanting something done. And he took his medical work very seriously, keeping up with his specialty, internal medicine, and going to clinics. When he was at West Point, he would go down to clinics at the Presbyterian Columbia Medical Center. He was very eager to give the best. And I know he was very conscientious. But I had the feeling that the officers in general didn't really have a great deal to do.
Hmm.
They seemed to have quite a lot of time on their hands. There was a great deal of social life, of course. This was particularly true of the wives, who did lots of bridge and so on, and parties and dinners. And I remember at West Point, my brother and his wife had a maid, a full-time maid, a live-in maid. But they also had a lot of work done by a stoker.
Hmm. Striker. A striker.
A striker, yes. He did all kinds of things for them,
hmm.
which were certainly way out of the line of any military.
Hmm. This was in the 30s.
Yes, this was in the 30s. And then when the war came, of course, this was a very different thing. I can only say that these were pleasant experiences socially. I met various people, including people of the general's rank. My brother at that time was a colonel. And
his name was Ralph Curdy,
I didn't think too much about it, but I remember that my younger daughter visiting West Point was taken to the parade ground, and she asked her uncle, said, "Is this a place where they learn how to kill people?" Reflecting, I suppose, something that I must have said to her, I don't remember. But I remember in her childish innocence, she said, "Is this where they practice how to kill each other?" I thought, well, out of the mouths of babes and sucklings, we shall learn.
Yeah, I think you mentioned that you'd met General Stillwell,
yes.
Senator Joe Stillwell.
And later I saw a good deal of his widow. After my brother had died, and my sister-in-law bought a house at Carmel, and Mrs. Stillwell was living in Carmel, so they were very close friends.
Winifred, I think her name was.
They were very close friends.
I got a questionnaire back from their daughter about her life.
Yes, I remember meeting their daughter.
I think her name's Winifred,
I think
too.
So.
Well, I just wanted to get that in because it aroused my curiosity the other day. When we left off the tape the other day, you were just starting to talk about Mr. Haskins and his interest in medieval intellectual history.
In my first year of graduate work, Haskins offered a new course, the intellectual history of the Middle Ages. It was a wonderful course because he had to give us the results of his long-sustained research on the reception of Arabic learning, mathematics, science, medicine, and so on. He hadn't yet published his famous 12th century Renaissance, but that was to come. So we had the advantage of a great deal of new material. We read Taylor's Medieval Mind, a big volume and two volumes, and a great deal of supplementary material. And I remember writing a long-term paper on the Chronicles of Froissart as documentary evidence of one aspect of the medieval mind. And one day I got up my courage to speak to Haskins, who was also dean of the graduate school, but I hadn't known him. And I said, I know you started out in American history and got a PhD at Hopkins with Herbert Baxter Adams when you were very young, 21, I believe, the rumor had it. And he said, yes, that was right. And I said, well, of course, our American experience is much briefer than the long span of the Middle Ages, and obviously much of our intellectual life is a derivative from that of Europe. And I know it doesn't compare, it wouldn't compare in any way with the richness of intellectual life in the Middle Ages. But I'm wondering whether you would think I was completely crazy to say that I would like someday to work up a course on American intellectual history and do in a very, very small way what you've done so magnificently in the Middle Ages. And instead of brushing me off as a brash young graduate student, he said, that's a very good idea. He said, I think no one really has explored that. And he encouraged me very much. Then he said, if you do this, you've got to know a lot about Europe and the agencies and institutions of intellectual life in Europe, because these were transferred in greater or less degree to America. And America has derived so much in terms of ideas and thought and political theories from Europe that you need to have a first-hand experience with Europe. And I said, well, that would be impossible because I would have to get a teaching job even to finish my PhD, and therefore I wouldn't be able to afford it. And he said, well, why don't you apply for a Sheldon Traveling Fellowship? And I said, well, my understanding, Mr. Haskins, is that these are reserved for students of European history who have to use the European archives. He said, well, it's true we haven't had any American historians go, but why don't you apply for one anyway? Well, this was a wonderful opening because I knew his influence in the graduate school would be very great. And sure enough, I got one. And he and Archibald Coolidge, who was the librarian and the only man in East Asia that Harvard had at that time, gave me letters of introduction to various people, including from Haskins, a letter of introduction to Charles Sestre, C-E-S-T-R-E, who, Haskins said, took American literature far more seriously than any American scholar did. It was at a time when American literature was considered simply a derivative branch of European, of English literature, and rather thin and not very important at all anyway. In the one course I'd had in American literature, the professor, who was a scholar in English literature, 18th century, did a good deal with the Puritans, but very, very little with the great 19th century writers. He had, of course, to discuss Emerson and Hawthorne, but he dismissed Melville as a writer of sea stories for boys that didn't amount to much. And Emily Dickinson wasn't even mentioned, and Mark Twain was beneath contempt, as a humorous writer for boys not to be taken seriously.
This is Greenough.
Yes. So I knew there was a great deal more to American literature than this, but no graduate work was given in it. This was an introductory course, undergraduate. So Haskins said, at the Sorbonne, you will find that Charles Sess gives lectures on different aspects of American literature. I'll give you a letter to him, and he did, and Sess was very kind. I followed his course. The first term at the Sorbonne was the West in American literature. That fitted in with what Turner was interested in, but didn't know too much about.
And did Seth know about Turner?
No, he didn't seem to know about him. But Haskins did. And the second term, Seth lectured on the New England poet E.A. Robinson.
Hmm.
So each term he would take up something different. And I gave my a long manuscript, about 600 pages, that I had written as the beginnings of the rough sketch of a PhD dissertation, which I called The Development of American Consciousness. This was a vast subject, much too big for a dissertation. But Turner encouraged me to experiment, and he said, American nationalism is a subject we need to know about, and you can go at it from the point of view of cultural and intellectual history. So he encouraged me and thought this was fairly good, and I gave it to Sesh, and Sesh said, if you translate this into French, you can have a soutenance here, an examination, and you can get the Doctor of University degree.
Hmm.
And I wrote to Haskins about that, and Haskins said, no, you better not do it. He said, the Harvard degree is worth much more than a Sorbonne degree if you're going to teach in America. And it would not be suitable to have two PhDs.
Hmm.
It would seem to reflect on either one institution or the other. So he said, just forget that idea that Mr. Sesh has suggested and present your work when you get it ready at Harvard. Well, to finish that story, Turner was retiring, and he said it would be better for me to have this approved by his successor, not really Frederick Merck, who took over the course in Western history, but by Arthur M. Schlesinger Sr., who was coming on from Iowa, who was interested in social history, and to some extent in intellectual history. And Turner said, just have him read the manuscript, and I think he'll be very much interested in this. I've been. I had been in Europe then for 15 months in the summer, and when I came back, I had a job at Smith College.
Did you stay in Paris?
No. No, I traveled around. The first summer was just all travel. And the second summer was all travel because my fiance came over. She was a young teacher at Smith College in psychology. She came over. We were married in Paris in a civil ceremony. And we spent the summer touring around, sightseeing. I'd done some of the things before, but it was nice to do them again. We did some climbing in the French Alps, in the Dolomites, in Italy and Austria. And I did some. I had already done some work in the Haushofer-Staat Archiv in Vienna on a term paper I'd written in a course on European history since 1815, in which William Langer, later a very distinguished European historian, had been the teaching assistant. And I had written a paper on America and the revolutions of 1848, and he encouraged me to go on with that. And I got rather fed up on just hearing lectures at the Sorbonne and visiting libraries and art galleries and going to such theaters as I could. So I decided it might be fun to go to Vienna and try my hand at a little research in archives. I'd never done any archival research, which I did, and it was a very interesting experience. And I found that the reports of the Austrian minister in Washington were full of material on American reactions to the revolutions of 1848, which had just then been crushed with the crushing of Kossuth's Hungarian rebellion by intervention of Russia and Prussia. And the American intervention movement, or Young America, had also more or less died out, but it was taken very seriously by the Chevalier de Hülsemann, who was the Austrian minister, and he reported to Count Schwarzenberg, the Minister of Foreign Affairs. And Schwarzenberg had a spy system in America under the auspices of Hülsemann. So the material was very good. And out of that, I made my first publication, Austria in the United States, 1848 to 1852, which was published in the Smith College Studies, and part of which had been in this dissertation, that is the Young America part. Well, Schlesinger read the manuscript and said, I'm sorry to tell you that I can't accept this. He said, it is not a PhD dissertation at all. He said, what you've got is a series of essays on American self-consciousness, as you call it. But he said, you have exhausted nothing. It's just surface work. And what you have to do to get a PhD, if you want me to be your advisor and sponsor, is to do a very thorough study of some small segment or something. And I said, well, do you think there's anything here that would lend itself to that? And he said, well, think it over. And I said, you go read it again yourself and come up with the suggestion, and I'll show you what I think of it. So I read it over, and I saw that I had 4 pages of the 600 pages on the early American peace movement, about which no one had written anything. So I wrote to him and said, would it be acceptable to write a thorough investigation of the early American peace movement, which nobody seems to have written on at all. There seems to be nothing on it. And he said, yes, that would be very good. It would be a good subject. Go ahead. So I really wrote that dissertation. I did the research and wrote it really on my own. I think I had maybe one conference, but I don't think so. I think I just wrote an occasional letter to Mr. Stasner indicating that I had discovered the William Ladd papers and what. Go ahead. So I really wrote that dissertation. I did the research and wrote it really on my own. I think I had maybe one conference, but I don't think so. I think I just wrote an occasional letter to Mr. Stasner indicating that I had discovered the William Ladd papers in Washington, that I discovered the Elihu Burritt papers in Britain, Connecticut, and that I was going on. Well, I was teaching full-time at Smith College, and my seniors were very nice when I explained to them that instead of almost having a PhD, which I had told them when I was getting the job, alas, my dissertation that I thought was a dissertation wasn't acceptable, and I was having to do one from scratch. Well, this was John Spencer Bassett, who worked in recent history, but also had edited the Jackson papers and written the life of Jackson, and Sidney B. Fay, who was already very well known for his work on revisionism of World War I. They were very nice, and they said, don't worry about your job. It was an assistant professor, but $1,800 a year. Don't worry about it. Just go ahead and do your research and write your thesis and in such spare time as you could, spare from your classes when they don't neglect them, because we attach a great importance to teaching, as Smith and College certainly did. So I did all of the research that year and in the summer, then wrote it up the next year, sent it down to Stasinger, and he wrote back within 2 weeks and said this was very acceptable and come down any time that was convenient for me, and they would arrange an oral examination, not only on the dissertation but on my whole special field, which according to the Harvard system you weren't examined on until you presented your dissertation. So that was my experience coming out of the conference. The conversation with Dean Hoskins then was my determination when I got a job and got my bearings to ask whether I could give a course on American intellectual history. And after I had been at Smith 2 or 3 years and knew my colleagues, including a very good friend that I'd made, my the other man in American history was Harold U. Faulkner.
Economic historian.
We were next door neighbors and very close friends. And he encouraged me to, he was older than I, and he suggested that he would support me. And so I spoke to John Spencer Bassett, and he had edited some of the William Byrd papers, and thus had some inkling of what intellectual history might be, though no one used the title of the word, no one used the term. And with his support and that of Faulkner, the department said I could give this course, which I did. And I think it was either the first or one of the first courses.
When was this? Do you remember?
It was 1928, I think.
28.
Then it wasn't until long after that that Howard Milford Jones came to Harvard and developed the history and literature program. And that Perry Miller then came and developed his great work in the New England Mind.
Did you use a textbook, or did you just
there was
have
no textbook
readings?
I was
wondering what you would use.
No, there wasn't. It didn't exist. There was none. No, I just had them do readings. And I worked for bibliography. I had them read some of Cotton Mather, and I had them read some of Jonathan Edwards. These were not available in reprints or paperbacks, but the library had at least one copy, and the Forbes Library in Northampton had a second copy of most of these things, a very good library. And that was it. The class was not too big at first. It was very small. It grew So that then the problem of readings became important, because this was the day before microfilm and paperbacks and so on. In fact, I once suggested to Alfred Knopf that he ought to publish some paperbacks as France and the European countries did. He said it would be impossible in America. He couldn't do it. And sooner or later, it was published and discovered that paperbacks were a big thing and you could do it. That was Alfred Knopf's original reaction when I suggested to him. He was a friend of my colleague in sociology, Harry Elmer Barnes. And it was at Barnes's house that I met people like Alfred Knopf, who was a friend of Barnes, and people like Mencken. H.L. Mencken was a great friend. He came to visit Barnes in Northampton. And
was Mencken as acerbic in his...
Yes,
social.
I just was there for one evening, you know, so I really couldn't say I knew him, but I met him. Yes, he was. And kind of a show-off, I thought, that night at least, sort of showing the other members of the faculty who were Barnes's friends or proteges what he could do in the way of performance. So anyway, that was how I got started in intellectual history, and I really think that I was one of the first to do it. Related to that was my idea of presenting American literature as one of the six fields that Harvard required for the PhD. In those days, you took a written examination, a very long one. I guess it was 2 days, I can't remember. But there were six fields in all, and you wrote on five fields for your prelims, or as they called them, generals. And I had the Renaissance and Reformation, English constitutional history, the history of political theory, from the Greeks on, and Russian history, which was very interesting, coming down to 1917. We read the great classics in English that Khrushchev had been translated, not Khrushchev, but I can't quite think. One of the great still read. There was also an economic history by a Canadian historian, which had been translated. We also read German and French works on Russian history. I didn't read Russian, of course. So then, for the sixth field, then one field was to be American and colonial history. That was the fifth field. Then there was the special field, which was the 19th century, American history of the 19th century. And you were examined on that. When you presented, there were only 20 years in the 20th century at this time, so these didn't count. This was considered current events or something. So the history department considered my request to present as my other field, American literature. And by this time, Greenough wasn't teaching it at all. Liz Perry, who had been the editor of the Atlantic Monthly, who had been brought in by President Lowell to encourage to give a course which would make the undergraduates really like literature. And he was a great teacher and he succeeded in that, but he was not a scholar in the technical sense. But he did have an interest in American literature, and I've taken a reading course with him where we read American texts. So the history department then understandably said American literature is not a sufficiently important field to be counted as a field for the PhD, but if you will supplement it and call the field American History and Thought, we will accept that as a field. Well, nobody knew what the history of American thought was. It didn't exist in any literature or historiography. But I read what I could, and so I came up for the examination in these five fields, which had already been examined on in writing. But now there was the oral examination. And they asked Miss Perry to come to be the one to examine me on American literature. And he began by saying, well, gentlemen, this is the first occasion I've ever had to examine anyone in American literature. I really don't, and thought, he said, I really don't know where to begin with this thought business. But he said, I think we might take a stab and ask the candidate to say what relationships he sees, if any, between Mary Baker G. Eddy, the Puritans, and the Transcendentalists. Well, that was a very good question. I never thought of Mary Baker G. Eddy as being an important thought of American thought. I realized, of course, that she was, and I knew enough about science and health to be able to make a stab at it. And then we got on very nicely. And
who were your other professors in those fields?
Well, there was McIlwain in English history, constitutional history. He was an excellent scholar. There, Lasky in the history of political theory, as I remember it. I'd taken his course. McIlwain also succeeded Lasky in that field. And I had listened, I think it was Lasky. And for early American history, Morrison. And for Russian history, it was Professor Lord, who later became a Roman Catholic priest after his conversion. And in the Renaissance and Reformation, it was Professor Merrim, who was a specialist in that field, and particularly in the Spanish part of the Renaissance. So that was my, and these were
Morrison
real work out. The examination was a very serious affair. I entered that room in fear and trembling, because I knew how little I knew and how much I was expected to know in five fields as different. That's Russian history, English history, the Renaissance and Reformation, and only one in American history, colonial history, and which was supposed to be my American history, supposed to be my research. When I came down from my final examination, the committee was Schlesinger, Merck, and a visiting professor, C.K. Webster, from either Oxford or London, and who had read my dissertation and who asked whether whether the peace movement hadn't set back the cause of peace more than it had contributed to it.
That's an interesting
other questions. But that examination was much easier than the original one.
They had
already decided that this was an acceptable dissertation. But Merck asked me some questions that I couldn't answer. I remember, to my shame, he wondered now how wheat in 1850 would get from Wisconsin to New York. And I could only think of the Erie Canal. I knew that if it could get to Buffalo, I couldn't remember what canals there were, what railroads had been built. And he said, I remember he said, was there a railroad that would take wheat from western Wisconsin to Milwaukee? And I didn't know whether there was or not. Actually, there was one in 1857, one of them, but not in 1850. I didn't know that at the time. I thought probably there was a railroad. But anyway, it was a pleasant experience after my having to write two dissertations. I used to tell my PhD candidates that I thought I was unique in having written two PhD dissertations, one with Turner, which was not acceptable by his successor, to his successor, and one with Mr. Schlesinger, which I had done all on my own, except that he had approved of it in the end. And therefore, they shouldn't fret about doing one dissertation. I had done two to get a degree. So anyway, it's an interesting part of academic history. And I was telling it once to our colleague Bill Taylor. Bill said, well, when the history department said that you could present a field with American literature and thought, that was the beginning, academically speaking, of American intellectual history. When they decided that you could do that. He said that was the beginning of the new discipline, when they decided you could do this. Well, I was there sort of
at the beginning.
Well,
in your graduate program at Harvard, was there a mixture of lecture classes and seminars?
At Harvard, in my day, I don't know how it is now, but in my day, there were lecture courses which were open to both graduates and majors in the field, people who were concentrating in the field, and upperclassmen. And that was true of the Renaissance and Reformation. I'd had a good many of these courses as an undergraduate, so I didn't have to take as many as normally one would, but I had to take Russian history, and I hadn't had English constitutional history. I hadn't had the Renaissance and Reformation, so I had those courses. They were lecture courses, but also the great emphasis was put on the term papers. And these were not just a slight affair, but they had to be research papers. You had to use primary documents. So this was the graduate part of it. Then there were the seminars. And I had a seminar with a man not well known, who later went to Reed College, But it was a very good seminar. I learned more than I did in Turner Seminar, really, about the techniques of research. It was Rex Aragon, who was interested in Latin American history and the relations between the United States and Latin America. And this was a seminar on diplomatic relations between Latin America and the United States in the 19th century. And there we used government documents, and we had learned a lot about bibliography, and we read Langlois and Seignobos on historical method. And it was an excellent training, which was the only thing of that kind that I got.
Now, how did he spell his name?
A-R-R-A-G-O-N. And he was a very good teacher. We later became friends when he was at Reed College. In fact, when I was at Smith, he invited me out to take a job at Reed College, but I didn't want to do that.
Well, how did Mr. Turner run a seminar?
We didn't we didn't read any of the manuals on historical method, such as Langlois and Seignobos, which was then the principal and except the Dahlmann Weitz book in German, which Haskins had all of his graduate students read in his seminar basement. Turner just assumed that his own example was enough to get us going, and he emphasized the importance of government documents and newspapers. He was a great believer in the importance of newspapers and the writings of frontier people, travel literature, and reminiscences of pioneers and settlers, and anything about land companies that, in the way of primary materials. So we were...
Paul Gates has really picked up on that
Paul
part.
Paul picked up on that. Paul Gates was one of Rick's students, so he's a little bit younger.
He's a little bit later.
But Turner, Merck really got his idea about that from him. Also, this course of Turner's and the seminar included American immigration to the West. Marcus Hansen was one of my fellow students.
He was
one of Turner's PhDs. He finished before I did, so I think I was the last of Turner's PhD students. But there were very good people. There was Jim Hedges, who later was at Brown University and wrote a very important biography of the Brown brothers and economic history of Rhode Island. He didn't go on with the West, though he did a dissertation on some aspect of the history of the West. But after he got to Brown, he used the Brown papers for the writing, the development of the industrial and business aspects of the Brown brothers. And there was Howard K. Beale.
Oh, he was in Turner's seminar.
Not the year I was in it.
Ah.
He was in it the next year, but he was in the graduate school, so I knew him. And there was Paul Buck, who later became the provost of Harvard.
Yes.
And who wrote his dissertation with Schlesinger later.
Was his dissertation Road to Reunion?
Yes.
Was that his dissertation?
That was done with Schlesinger. That is, Paul didn't finish his PhD with Turner, but he was in Turner's seminar. I don't know what he did, but I knew him very well. We were close friends. So that there were very good graduate students, and all of them were heard from later. Some of them became very well known.
What sort of personality did Turner have?
He was a...
How was he in person?
Very soft-spoken. Gentle in his way of dealing with people. He's a great out-of-doors man, a great fisherman. He used to always go to either Maine or Canada for trout fishing. And he and Miss Perry used to go fishing together in Quebec. He also was not... he was interested in the theater and music, but primarily, he was a scholar, and as Billington indicates in his very interesting biography, he was very much a man's man in the sense that he really didn't care for the social life, which many academic people at Harvard do, I think. He was very devoted to his students. He took his undergraduates in their stride, as he did. As I indicated, the other make an effort to interest them. If they were interested, fine. If they weren't, he didn't try to play up to them by telling them interesting stories or anecdotes about the West. Indians and cowboys, none of that.
Hmm.
It's straightforward, down-to-earth, largely exposition of maps and documents, even in his lecture course. It was really, the lecture course was tantamount to graduate level, though some undergraduates did get in there in one way or another, not quite knowing what they were getting into, mm. expecting, I think, a Wild West show or something of the kind. So Turner was very devoted to his graduate students. He took us, he took us almost as younger colleagues. He expected that we were going to do very well, and his expectation made us pour our best effort. We didn't want to, we loved him, and we didn't want to disappoint him. So we really went all out to do our very best. This assumption that, of course, we were going to all be very well-known historians was very flattering, but also it was very challenging and very stimulating.
Mm.
And it was a very interesting, I think it came very natural to him. He didn't do it as a technique, it was just, he thought of us as younger colleagues. And he always said he learned as much from us as we could have learned from him. And I know he believed that. It wasn't just so much, so many words. So Turner was a great teacher of graduate students, even though I don't think he gave us the kind of rigid methodological training that many people giving a seminar do. I tried to make up for that. I tried to do more with that when I was teaching at a school, when I began teaching at Columbia and here. But on the other hand, we learned how to make these maps correlating all kinds of data with geography and plotting maps and curves and so forth. And we certainly had to use documents, but he just didn't seem to feel that it was necessary to teach us how to write. That would have been, to me, very helpful, because I really didn't know very well how to write. I had to learn it later.
Did he, when you turned in papers, did he
very elaborate
comments?
But these were more substantive in character.
Rather than the techniques of writing.
Technique of writing, no. They didn't do much with that. But he did do a great deal. And we always had a conference with our seminar papers. We had to do two seminar papers each semester. One was a substantive research report, what we had found in our own research. And the other one was what he called a problem paper, in which out of our larger paper, we had to isolate some kind of an historical problem and offer a solution for it as best we could. And he called that the problem paper. And that was very challenging, because, first of all, we hardly knew how to look for a problem, you know. We had to keep looking for what could you say was an historical problem. So it was very good in a sense. So his training, he gave us very good training, but it was not the characteristic out-of-the-book training. It was learning by doing, so to speak. And it worked, as his many productive graduate students over many years, I think, proved.
Well, did you have a... you mentioned that Morrison was on your committee. Did you have any courses with
him? Yes, I had two courses with Sam Morrison. I became a kind of a protege, curiously, of Sam. I think I was probably the only Middle Western student he'd had that showed any great interest in New England, which I did partly because of my own New England background. He was almost a professional New Englander, like his teacher, Channing. He invited me, I remember, once. I took a course in my senior year on colonial history. The first semester, colonial history, the second semester, the American Revolution. It was a very poor course in the sense of covering the ground.
Hmm.
He was interested in, at that time, in the Viking explorations of the New World. We spent the first 6 weeks of a course, which included undergraduates as well as first-year graduate students, on the question, did the Vikings make a landfall in what is now the Commonwealth of Massachusetts? Well, this involved not only reading the sagas, in translation, of course, but learning all we could about the flora and fauna of Massachusetts. We went, I remember, to the Bussey Institution, the botanical institution, to learn about all the flowers and vines and so forth that were mentioned in the sagas. We spent 6 weeks of a one-semester course on that. So you can imagine there wasn't a great deal of time for the 18th century. So when I had at Smith to teach a course on the colonial history, except that I had read for my examination, and I had read some Osgood and Andrews, which were then the standard works in early American history, but I really didn't know much about it. I had to work. I'd never even heard of Evans' American Bibliography down to 1800. I ran on to that by accident. I was going through the stacks, and I found it in the Smith College Library. I didn't know it existed. So Sam Morrison gave a course to his own liking, and you got his flavor, and he was a very interesting man with a nice sense of irony and a good deal of wit, intellectual wit. And I was his guest for more than one weekend at Concord, where he was then living. I remember once he said, "Would you like to walk around Walden Pond?" Or would I ever have been around Walden Pond? He didn't say a word all the time we were walking around the pond, and I didn't dare interfere because by saying something about it, maybe he's in some deep, profound thought. I don't want to interrupt. So then he said, "I think we'll drop in to see the Mrs. Emerson." He said, "They'll be having tea now." These were Ralph Waldo Emerson's own daughters. Very
really?
Elderly ladies.
Huh.
And they were always at home, apparently, for tea in the afternoons. Morrison was, as a Boston blue blood, one of their acquaintances or friends. We stopped in, and they were very polite to this Midwestern undergraduate student who professed a great interest in their father. And they said, "Would you like to see the library?" And they showed me his books, which were then very much as he had left them. Their brother, Dr. Emerson, was editing the Emerson journals. Mm-hmm. No, not the letters yet. Those came much later. But he was editing the journals.
Mm.
I didn't meet him, but they told me about that. So that was a very interesting experience.
My goodness. When I was in college, I had my American Lit professor went to Concord after he was discharged from the Army in 1919, and he would always show us, as the punchline in his lecture, a pencil that supposedly had been made by Thoreau, and Thoreau, you know, made pencils, and he had bought this.
It could well have been.
It could have been. In 1919, he picked it up.
Could well have been.
Well, Morrison, I only saw him once or twice, and of course he was then Admiral Morrison, I was just trying to think of the word. Formidable is not exactly it.
Yes, I think one could say formidable. He would be formidable to most people unless you knew him, unless you had some...
I was in the Library of Congress, and he came in the manuscripts division, and of course everything was still, and people started running around, and he was talking in a normal tone and everything.
Well, I liked his first wife very much. She was a very lovely person. She was reared the Green family, a very wealthy and educated family in Boston. They'd been merchants in their time. And she'd been brought up in Paris, so she spoke English with a slight French accent. She was a lovely person. Later, I taught the eldest Morrison daughter at Smith. She was in one of my classes at Smith, and we came to know her quite well. And to her father, I did provide, because her father had been very kind to me as an undergraduate. We did what we could for her. Their son, Peter, didn't turn out very well. He was a great disappointment, I think, to his father. But the daughter's married. I don't know what ultimately happened to the two. The second Mrs. Morrison was a Baltimore belle. I met her at the AHA when Morrison was president, but I never really knew her. By this time, Sam disapproved of me because I had written so much on the peace movement and was something of a pacifist, and he didn't really approve of that. And though he had had a certain interest in left-wing liberalism when I knew him at Harvard, he'd become very conservative in his later years. However, I had a very nice note for him shortly before he died. The AHA was going to meet in Boston, and he wrote to me and said, "I'm not very well, but I'm going to, I'm inviting a few people for tea, and I would like very much to have you come." Well, I have decided not to go to that meeting, so I wrote back and said I was very sorry because I would love to have seen him. This is just shortly before he died.
Well, I know he was at the OAH, I think it was Philadelphia, just a few months before he died, because I didn't go, but some people told me they'd seen him there. His book, The Exploration of North America,
yes,
had just come out.
It was amazing what he did in his later years. He was a gifted writer. He had a great sense of style in the Parkman tradition. Parkman was his great hero. I guess he did have us read in that course in Parkman, come to think of it. I guess he did have us read some Parkman.
You know, Parkman's, what would you call it, his notebooks have just been published in paperback.
I didn't know that.
I was able to, I picked them up at a Marlboro store in New York 4 years ago.
I didn't know that. Wilbert Jacobs is at Santa Barbara, is doing a new study of Parkman. I had said, well, I would have thought the Doherty life did about everything one could do, but he said, no. There's a lot yet to be done. And I don't know just what he's doing, but I saw him last winter when I was in Santa Barbara.
I wanted to ask you, what are your techniques of working? Do you have certain times of the day that you would write, or,
no,
you know?
Just
whatever?
When I could seize the time. I have far more students here than I think any of you have now.
Yes, you do.
Because there are now... several of you who do American history, and we don't have nearly as many graduate students as we did when there were jobs to be had. So, right after World War II, I had between 25 and 30 in my seminar. And, you know, this was a terrific job to read papers and correct them and have conferences with so many students. And I think in all, counting my Columbia PhDs, I had between 90 and 100. There's a lot of PhD dissertations too.
Whatever?
When I could seize the time. I have far more students here than I think any of you have now.
Yes, you do.
Because there are now several of you who do American history, and we don't have nearly as many graduate students as we did when there were jobs to be had. So, right after World War II, I had between 25 and 30 in my seminar. And, you know, this was a terrific job to read papers and correct them and have conferences with so many students. And I think in all, counting my Columbia PhDs, I had between 90 and 100. This is a lot of PhD dissertations to...
I've got a list of your PhDs that was typed out, I think, and I've got it in my desk.
And well, then I have several phenomenal several at Columbia, too. So,
talking about your...
He was not a good teacher, but he was a...
Morrison.
Yes, he was not a good teacher.
You were talking about your way of working when you had so many graduate students and so many...
Well,
plans.
I just had to seize whatever time I could. There was no really regular time. And in those days, we didn't have as much research leave as is now possible. The So I didn't have... a great deal of freedom. Most of my writing was done in the summer. Because after I had paid my graduate school debts by teaching summer school, I just resolved, with the enthusiastic encouragement of my wife, never to teach summer school again. And the result of that was, we went to Lyme, New Hampshire. I had a study in the Dartmouth College Library, which is an excellent library, much better than most university libraries. And there was a group of historians, Kirkland, Beale, and various others. So we were a very stimulating group to each other. We did a lot of hiking, weekends, and so on. And I worked, I got in there at 8 o'clock.
At Dartmouth?
Yes, at the Dartmouth College Library. And I worked till into the afternoon. And then in the later afternoon, I did gardening, or working around the place, or taking hikes. short hikes and so forth. Lewis Hunter, very distinguished historian of technology, was one of this group. And his new book, in three volumes, the first volume has just been published, great acclaim. It was a very interesting group. We all had these old houses, which we fixed up and loved. So my writing was chiefly done in the summertime.
Mm.
And then in the winter, in Christmas or spring vacations, I would go and do research at whatever library.
Mm.
I had one very good year at the Huntington Library when I was still at Smith College. And that was a very rich year because there were nothing to disturb me. And that was in 1936 and 37.
What were you working on then?
I was working on the growth of the
You were working on that?
I was actually, when I was doing that, I was going through a great many 4th of July orations and academic orations, orations given by presidents who were being inaugurated or professors who were being given a chair and giving an oration in connection with that. And 4th of July orations, dime novels, which nobody had done anything with at that time.
Mm.
And then more serious things, too, that I was working on. I worked on Locke, the American interest in John Locke.
Mm.
And I did a paper on that, which was published in the Huntington Library quarterly. It's a long paper. And I did a paper on the American dime novel, which was published in the Yale Review. It was a lighter thing, but really good. And various other things. This was a follow-up on my interest in American patriotism and loyalty came after that.
Mm.
And that was where I used so much of this 4th of July material.
The roots of Americans.
Yeah, roots of American loyalty. Then I had the summers, and I don't think I had a full year of research for. Well, I had started my first one as a Guggenheim year, which I was where I did my second book on the peace movement.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't have a great many of these. And with so many graduate students, it was always, I felt, unfair to them to go away for a whole year, even if I could get the money, because I was able to help them in many different ways. So I didn't have any regular time for it, except the summertime.
Mm.
Was I very conscientiously, just this is my writing time, and I didn't let anything interfere with it.
When did you buy the house in New Hampshire?
We bought it in 1939.
Mm.
I was then teaching at Columbia,
and
we didn't like being in the city in the summertime. Mm. It was unpleasant and hot. And various friends, Kirkland had been in Channing Seminar, and was a Channing student, but he was a friend of mine at Harvard. And he had bought a very beautiful old house, much better than ours, in Thetford, which is very close to where we were. And he started this custom of historians buying houses. There were several of us all together. And so we bought ours in 1939. We'd already spent two or three summers in this area, once in the Beale House when the Beales were abroad, and once in a house in Norwich, Vermont, which we rented. So we knew the area when we bought the house. The house, as I said, was an old house that was built in 1792, and was thus almost 200 years old.
Mm.
And at that time, there were lovely meadows and pastures, which unfortunately now have become grown over with, to a great extent with trees.
Mm.
But they're about 85 acres altogether.
Mm.
Mostly woodland, very pleasant. That's the house I'm going to have to sell.
When did you first start teaching at Beloit?
Yes.
Could you tell a little about that? How many hours you were teaching?
I must have told you this before. Perhaps it should go on record. After getting a master's degree, which at Harvard was not a very important degree, it simply meant you. It meant that you'd been at the Harvard Graduate School for one academic year. There was no master's essay.
Mm.
You had done seminar papers, and that was it. I had to earn some money, and so I got a job at Beloit College, where there were two historians, where there was one historian and one political scientist, each of whom had long wanted what they called a second man. But the college wasn't able to afford that, and each one was so much the rival of the other that one wouldn't let the other have one unless he had one. Finally, they compromised and decided that they would get a man from the Ivy League. They were very keen about the Ivy League. Professor Richardson was a Yale man, and Professor Way actually was from Wisconsin, though Wisconsin was in general rather looked down on, I believe, as inferior to the Ivy League. They were quite snobbish, actually, which I didn't like, but I was amused by it. And so I got this job. I taught 9 hours on the books of history and 9 hours in political science.
Mm.
Now, the interesting thing was I had had only a freshman course in political science, an introductory course on imperative government. That was all I knew about political science, but that seemed to make no difference. I was expected to enter into it. And after the first 6 weeks, Professor Richardson, the European historian, became very ill. I had to have drastic surgery, and the dean asked me to take over his courses. And I said, well, some of them conflict with my 18 hours that I'm already teaching. Well, the dean said, you can teach half time of your course, and then the other half of the 50 minutes you teach Professor Richardson. Well, I said, he's teaching English constitutional history. I guess I can do that. I said, I've had medieval history, but I'll do the best I can. So I was teaching all of my, they had only 15 hours a week as against my 18, but that was because I was a junior member split halfway across the board. So I was doing all of that. Professor Richardson did not improve. And then, though this sounds incredible, it's really true, Professor Way became very, very seriously ill, also had surgery. And this time the President Brannan called me in. He said, we know you're already working quite hard with Professor Richardson. He said, we're going to have to ask you also to take over Professor Way's course. I said, Professor Brannan, I can't do it. I said, I'm already doing more than I can do. It's ridiculous. And I said, first of all, Professor Way is teaching international law. I said, I've never had a course in international law. How could I teach it? Well, he said, you can read the textbook ahead. And I said, well, anyway, there's too many conflicts. I can't do it. I said, why don't you get a graduate student from Madison who has probably passed his examinations and is working on his dissertation, and he would be much better equipped than I am. President Brannan said, well, he said, we don't like to get people from Madison unless we have to. We are very much oriented to the Ivy League. We consider ourselves, as you know, the Yale of the West. We were founded by the Yale Band, and we prefer to have Ivy League people if we can get them, and here you are. Well, if I'd had any guts, I would have said, I won't do it. But in those days, students or young people, I was very young, just about 1 year of graduate, didn't speak up the way they'd learned to do, fortunately, or at least I didn't. I said, there is a lady here on the faculty who has a PhD in American history from Wisconsin. She asked me if I was interested in reading her dissertation, and I read it, and it happened to be a subject I was much interested in myself, the reform movements of the 1840s. It was a very good dissertation. She wasn't able to get a job teaching American history because women weren't wanted in American history. And she had to retool herself in domestic science, and she is your professor of domestic science. I said, she's much better equipped to do the American history than I'm doing. And she could at least relieve me there. Well, he said, Professor Richardson and Professor Way would die in their beds at the hospital if they knew that Professor Robinson was teaching any of their courses. And they spurned the idea of a professor of domestic science anyway. And as for her Wisconsin degree, they've never recognized it. So there was this lady who wanted to teach American history and was prohibited even to fill in an emergency. They didn't get better well enough to teach that. We were on the term, on the prior semester. And I had to stay in Beloit all during Christmas vacation and read the blue books of all of these courses. They made out the exams. They were able to do that from their beds. And the only thanks I got for all of this was a copy of James Strussel Adams' New England, Early New England, which Professor Way gave me with an inscription. And so I wrote to my tutor at Harvard, Fred Merck, and I said, can you possibly get me a graduate scholarship for next year? I really can't take this. This is terrible. I was living in the house of the Dean of Women, Dean Tannehill, who was very, very snobbish. She considered herself a social elite person. She said she'd been brought to Beloit to improve the manners of the faculty and students. She had a silver tea set, and her mother had a southern background, Kentucky, I think, or something. And they considered themselves extremely polished. She did read the Atlantic Monthly. And she was Dean of Women and gave a course on the history of the English language. She had a master's degree from Wellesley, so she said. And she, when I got there to take two rooms on her third story of the deanery, she said, how do you pronounce your name? And I said, well, in Switzerland it's called Curti, but I said, in America we just say Curti, that seems to be easy. She said, that isn't the correct pronunciation. She said, it should be Curti. She said, it sounds better. I said, but Dean Tannehill, it never was Curti. She said, well, I've studied the history of the English language, and this is the proper pronunciation. And she said, I'm going to introduce you. And I said, yes, but this isn't an English name. It's a Swiss name. She said, never mind, the rules of the language are the same in all countries. And so I was Professor, I was only an instructor, without a PhD, certainly not a, but I was always introduced as Professor Curti.
How much were you paid?
$1,800. They offered me $2,000 if I would come back a second year. But in the meantime, Merck, good soul that he was, had got me a fellowship, and I was able to go back to Cambridge.
And then Professor Robinson is the one who left that money for the chair
and
here that Colonel Lerner.
When I came to Wisconsin in 1942, Professor Naplan, the chairman of the department, said, I look over your credentials, I see you taught for a year at Beloit College. I said, yes, sir, I did. And he said, well, did you ever know anyone by the name of Florence Robinson? I said, indeed I did. I knew her quite well. I read her dissertation at her request. And she served tea at the faculty meetings, which she hated to do, but somebody had to, and she was the professor of home economics. And he said, well, she left her estate to the history department. But we've never been able to do anything about it because the university settled with the heir with her brother and sister for letting them use the income of the estate as long as they lived. And they've lived a very long time. But he said, I've known about this bequest, and nobody here has ever heard of Florence Robinson. And so I said, well, I guess I'm the only one who ever knew her. And so I am. Nobody, I think, nobody knows her.
Well,
so then Howard Beale and I, wanting to have a woman in the department, we both felt that a coeducational university where a considerable part of the students were women, ought at least to show to those women that it was possible for a woman to be a scholar and a university teacher. And but there wasn't enough money to establish a Florence Robinson chair. Neil and I said, well, why don't you get somebody like Bessie Pierce at the University of Chicago to come up and give some lectures and keep this thing alive? But we didn't do that for whatever reason. And nothing was done until we were notified that unless we did something, the University of Chicago would get what was left. Well, and so I think I'm probably the only living person now who really knew Florence Robinson. I'm 85 almost, and so this is a long time. This was 1922, and she died, I think, about 1930. I don't know the dates. I never knew anything about her after I left Beloit, but I did know her quite well. The snobbishness of Beloit is incredible. It, fortunately, it doesn't exist now. They're more sensible. And I was telling this story once to Martha Peterson, who was their president, and whom I had known when she was a dean here. And I guess this was one reason why I was given this Beloit degree a couple of years ago, as a kind of a makeup for their expectation of me as a very young and helpless student, a young instructor. But I accepted the degree, and I'm very glad to have it along with the others as a token of my first teaching experience. Well, I was very poorly equipped to teach. I knew really shamefully a little, but I guess I knew more than the students, and that was at least that. Very nice to me, Mr. Richardson, Professor Richardson, Professor Way. They couldn't have been kinder, in spite of the fact they imposed, by their illness, all of this work. Their conception of the administration's conception of standards is left something to be desired.
Well, you taught at Simmons College.
I taught at Simmons. This was to earn some money. I had very little money. My family couldn't do much for me. And they got me through college with such scholarships as I have, but these scholarships were never enough. So I taught at Simmons the introductory course in European history for a year. And at the same time, I had probably one course at Harvard. I think that was the year I did a reading course with Mr. Turner and a reading course with Miss Perry. That was the year while I was teaching full-time at Simmons. That was to earn some money. I had a wonderful chief at Simmons, Professor Harry Verrill, who was a medievalist, one of Haskins' students, and he was a wonderful person to be with. I learned a lot about teaching from him. He was a very good teacher.
How does he spell his name?
V-A-R-R-E-L-L. We became friends. I was often a guest at their house, and I was very sorry when he died.
Well, Smith then was really your first full-time job over a...
And this was a wonderful college in which to teach. The girls were very well prepared. All of them had taken college entrance exams. No one had come without being well prepared for college work. In general, they were very hard working. Harder working than most male students would be. They took it quite seriously. They were very much interested in what I had to give them, particularly in the intellectual history course. And I always had some very brilliant girls in the honors program, which was made up of small groups of four or five students learning how to write and read and do special papers. The president of Smith was a very great Shakespearean scholar and the only great educator I've ever taught under. William Allen Nielsen, a Scotsman. And he had come to America to make his way and taught in the so-called Breadwinners School, one of our first adult education schools on the east side in Lower East Side of New York. And then had got a job at Bryn Mawr, where one of his colleagues was Woodrow Wilson. And then was called to Harvard. And in my freshman year, I had a course on the history of English literature, which was given by Kittredge, their great Shakespearean, their great Chaucer and Shakespearean specialist. And Nielsen lectured on 17th Elizabethan period other than Shakespeare. And later at Smith, he taught Shakespeare until he finally said the scholarship of Shakespeare studies is so great, I can't keep up with it, and it would be unfair even undergraduates to go on with it. He was a great internationalist, a great friend of the League of Nations. His wife was a German lady whose father had been the prime minister of Baden-Baden. She was very cultivated. She introduced many of us, including me, to Thomas Mann and his novels. And the Nielsens had very distinguished guests, both from Great Britain and from this country, and they were very generous in inviting members of the faculty to share these evenings. Nielsen had great understanding of human nature and was an ardent friend of academic freedom. The legislature of Massachusetts passed an act requiring all teachers in private and public colleges to take a loyalty oath. Nielsen had been to one of the hearings and to protest against this, but it had passed in the 1930s in one of these waves of patriotic fervor. And in the faculty meeting, Nielsen said, there is nothing in this act, as I read it, that requires the oath to be taken individually. He said, I see nothing in it that would prevent us, if we want to, from taking it collectively. And he said, do I hear a motion that anyone might propose, if they're so minded, that we take this oath collectively? Of course, we jumped at that chance. And so he administered the oath collectively.
That's a neat way.
It was a very neat way. Anyone who didn't want to take it, but took his honor.
You
there was a very unpopular woman professor of French from the Sorbonne. She had written a couple of novels, which the French department said weren't very good. And she, however, had been promoted to a professorship on the ground that she had the doctorat de l'état, very, very high competitive degree. There were people in the department who had the French degree, doctorat d'agrégation et lettres, but no one who had this degree, so they had to promote her to, but she was very unpopular. Finally, a professor from the Sorbonne, or an officer from the Sorbonne, came over to America to see how Sorbonne people were doing in teaching French. And he knew exactly what degrees they had from the Sorbonne. And he came to Smith and he saw that Mademoiselle Amboisoir was in the catalogue as having the agrégation et lettres. Well, he knew she didn't. Mm-hmm. All she had was a licence, which is like a master's degree. So he told President Nielsen, and the word got around to the French department. Mm. They were furious that she had won her professorship by false pretenses. They demanded her immediate expulsion. And she came and wept on Nielsen's bosom, I guess, or whatsoever, and penitent and sorrowful. And I guess his compassion was moved, and so he told the chairman of the French department that Smith would not dismiss Mademoiselle Amboisoir. And I was furious. They loved Nielsen, but this was too much. And he said, never mind. He said, she won't last very long. He said, I give her about 2 months to last.
Hmm.
But he said, the opprobrium will be so great, she won't be able to take it. He was very wise. She left in about 2 or 3 months. She couldn't stand the disgrace.
The reputation.
She couldn't stand it. This was his way of dealing with people. A few years ago, our then chairman, Peter Smith, and he was married to his first wife, said that his mother-in-law was coming on from Denver. She'd been one of my students at Smith College.
Huh.
Would I come to dinner? Well, of course, I didn't remember her because it was a long time before, and this was, of course, in recent American history that she had taken, not the intellectual history, which was more. And she said, you know, Mr. Kearney, you had a great influence on me at Smith. And I said, well, I hope it was for the good. But she said, that's open to question. And I said, well, please tell me about this. I'd like to know my sins of omission and commission. And she said, well, I'm joking, but she said, I came from a very, very conservative family. My father was a wealthy banker or businessman. And I was greatly impressed by your interpretation of the New Deal, which we've just been living through. It was almost contemporary history. And I went home on Christmas vacation, and I indicated that I was pro-FDR and pro-New Deal, and my father hit the ceiling. And he was so angry, but he said, I didn't know what he was going to do. He just, dressed me down and practically disowned me, which I went back to college. And I had a summons to come to President Nielsen's office. She said, I was scared to death. I didn't know what was up. And she said, I went to President Nielsen's office. He got out a letter, and he said, let's see. He said, how old are you? And she said, well, I'm 21 or whatever. And he said, well, he said, I think you're old enough to have learned better than you seem to have how to deal with your father. He said, you don't seem to have learned very much about how to deal with your father. He said, now I have two daughters, and he said, I hope they will be able to deal with me when they're a little bit older, better than you seem to be able to deal with your father. So she still didn't know what all this. She said, I have a letter here from your father demanding Professor Curtis' dismissal from the college. He said, of course we don't dismiss people that way. And he said, we have academic freedom. And he said, I think what you've got to do is to learn how to talk with your father. There are ways of talking with him.
where you don't stir up his anger and his prejudices without betraying yourself. There are ways of doing it, and you have to learn those. And I said to Peter Smith's mother, I said, you know, I've never dreamed of it. It never would have occurred to me that any parent would have written in demanding my firing. But this was the way Nielsen handled situations. He was a very great leader, a very wise man, a great scholar, and very much of a son of the Renaissance. His learning was very wide and by no means shallow. He was the only president of a college that I would regard as a really great educational leader, an intellectual leader, as well as an administrator.
You mentioned some time ago that you'd met Willa Cather.
Yes. Well, my wife was teaching psychology at Smith, and we were always at home on Wednesday afternoon for any of our students who wanted to come for tea, and Smith girls did that. And I always asked the girls who from my class where they came from. They came from all over the country, and one girl said she came from Nebraska. Well, I said, well, I'm from Nebraska too. I said, what part of Nebraska do you come from? I said, well, I come from Red Cloud. And I said, oh, that's interesting. I said, have you ever heard of Willa Cather? Have you ever read any of her novels? She said, well, Willa Cather is my aunt. And I said, well, how interesting. I said, I'm one of her great fans. I've read all of her novels and admire her very much. And so this girl said, well, she comes up to see me every once in a while. She's financing my education at Smith and that of my brother at Amherst. And she comes up from New York fairly often to see us. And if you'd like to, the next time she comes, I'll invite you to have tea with us. And she did. And so I saw her, and I think I saw her two or three times after that. She was very quite formal, not as outgoing as you often think little Westerners are, very much a lady. And we talked about Nebraska and the immigrants to Nebraska. I'd known Czechs and she had known them. And also, I had been brought up in the Episcopal Church, though I was no longer an Episcopalian. And she had traditionally always been an Episcopalian and was increasingly interested in Anglo-Catholicism, the High Church, and even Roman Catholicism. So we talked about religion and its emotional components. And the ritual still meant a great deal to me, though I had lost any belief in the creeds. So it was a very interesting experience to have known her even slightly. We've had some conversations with her about that.
Well, you once told me, and I was really, I thought about that, and I read the book. This is 20 years ago, that you thought The Professor's House, that she wrote, was your favorite academic novel.
Yes. And did you read the book?
Yes. Yes, Merle, you told me that, I think, my first year here.
Really?
At dinner one night, the curtains were there, and Ann and I, that must have been the spring of 62.
52.
And I read it at that time and was very much impressed by it, and I often think about it.
Well, it's a very interesting novel, the novella inside the novel. Tom Outland's story.
That's right.
Very good. Though Willa Cather always said...
Well, you once told me, and I was really... I thought about that, and I read the book. This is 20 years ago, that you thought The Professor's House, that she wrote, was your favorite academic novel.
Yes. And did you read the book?
Yes. Yes, Merle, you told me that, I think, my first year here.
Really?
At dinner one night, the curtains were there, and Ann and I, that must have been the spring of 62.
52.
And I read it at that time and was very much impressed by it, and I often think about it.
Well, it's a very interesting novel, the novella inside the novel, Tom Outland's story.
That's right.
Very good. Though Willa Cather always said she wasn't basing that on any particular professor. Actually, it was based to a considerable extent on, what was his name? He was one of my wife's teachers. She was an undergraduate at Nebraska. Got her PhD at Chicago, but she was an undergraduate at Nebraska. And she was particularly fond of this professor. He was a professor of philosophy, particularly aesthetics, and who was greatly interested in the Western Indians, including those at Mesa Verde.
And he did the Indian designs on the state capitol.
In Lincoln.
In Lincoln. He
was it Mackinder or something like that?
No, it wasn't Mackinder. No, he was the, I know who he was. I know, I once met him in Paris.
Hmm.
My wife and I were in Paris, and we happened to be staying at the same hotel on the left bank. And he remembered her from the Nebraska days, and we spoke briefly. I'll think of his name, but I can't write it at the moment. But he wrote, he was interested in the Indians and aesthetics, the philosophy of aesthetics, and a very gifted teacher. And he, a lot of him, goes into the professor. Also something of Professor Fling, who was a great enthusiast about the French Revolution.
Hmm.
And gave a very famous course in the French Revolution to undergraduates.
At Nebraska.
At Nebraska. So there were real people that went into her character, though she was very free in taking part of one and part of another, getting somebody who was very different from any actual person. But there was always one or more people that formed the basis for her character.
I wanted to ask you something, too. You told me some years ago about running into, I think it was Ely, at when you were teacher's college.
Yes, right.
I don't remember.
Remember that story? Well, I gave a seminar for the Graduate School of History, for the Graduate Department of History in South Hall. And my seminar room was up there on the top of the story. And the chairman of the executive officer was Carlton Hayes. And at one of the dinner meetings of the executive committee, which I was a member of, he said that President Butler had brought Professor Ely to Columbia because, unfortunately, all of his investments had gone sour, and he was practically penniless with a new wife and some young children, I think. And he was too old to teach. But President Butler thought that he could perhaps be someone that graduate students and others in economics and history could consult with, talk to. And nobody had apparently shown up. But Hayes said it would be very nice if any of us who had seminars on that floor would drop in and say hello. So I did. I did. I knew enough about him to. I knew the famous academic freedom cases. I didn't know much more. I never really read much of anything. I might have read something that he'd written. Well, he was a very old man indeed, and I had the feeling of his brother senile. And he said he had hoped that people with students would come in. He said there had been no students. Only one or two members of the faculty had stopped in to see him, which was a great contrast from his days of teaching out in Wisconsin and Northwestern. And we had a little chat about his Wisconsin. This was before I ever knew I was coming to Wisconsin.
Mm.
And he told me his version. I said, well,
oh, the famous incident.
An academic freedom case in Wisconsin in which you were involved. Oh, yes, he said that was back in the 1890s.
Mm.
And so he reminisced a little bit about it more than I knew. I only knew that there had been a case. I didn't really know any of the details. And I had no idea that we would sometime be studying, that Carson and I would sometime be very much interested in.
How many hours were you teaching at Smith?
Oh, that was a good program, 9 hours.
Hmm.
And that was a sensible program in contrast to the 18 that I taught at Beloit.
When did you get the idea to start work on Growth of American Thought?
Well, it came out of my teaching, out of this course at Smith. When I went to Columbia, I gave two courses and a seminar. The seminar was in Studies in the History of American Nationalism.
Hmm.
And these were almost entirely students who were
candidates for degrees in the graduate faculty at Columbia itself. I might have had, I had one or two teachers, college people, one very good one, wrote a very good dissertation, was published. Then I gave a course on the history of American social thought, which was largely made up by graduate students at Columbia, but also some graduate students at Teachers College. And then I had an evening course once a week at Teachers College on the history of American education. And I knew almost nothing about that. I had to work it up from scratch. I had written The Social Ideas of American Educators,
yes,
which Jürgen Hertz's seminar talked about night before last, when I was there, and gave it a much better rating than I would have, and indicated that it was, had really been a landmark in the history of American education historiography. So that was my program at Columbia, and I had some very good students. I suggested Holstadter's dissertation topic to him, though I wasn't there to supervise it in the end. With Professor Harry Comer, a close friend of mine, with whom I was on extremely warm terms, again. I've had several letters from a student who's writing a dissertation on Holstadter, wanting my reminiscences and so forth. I've turned what letters I have from him to the over to the Historical Society.
That would be interesting.
I told her that, you know, she could have the copy of the maid. And then I gave her whatever reminiscences I could. We were very good friends. And he was in this course on the history of American social thought. And we often had lunch together, so we were very good.
He did his dissertation on social Darwinism.
Yes, and I suggested the topic.
I read that book. I think I was when I was in graduate school.
Well, for a long time it was the standard book. Now there have been a more recent book which revises him in rather important ways, I think. I've read that book. I can't remember the author.
I can't either. Cause I...
But that was Dick's book was the first one on the subject of any concern, of any note. So that was a very interesting program. But actually at Columbia, I was the member of two departments. I was the member of the Social Studies Department at Teachers College. This involved department meetings, sitting on Teachers College dissertation committees. I was also on the faculty of political science, and before I left Columbia, I was also on the faculty of humanities. I was on two faculties. This involved going to two different sets of Columbia meetings, as well as the executive committee of the department, which was made up of the full professors of the department. And those were evening dinner meetings, which were very awkward from the point of view of one living in Brownsville and commuting. And because I was supposed to know something about a lot of things, I was asked to be on Columbia committees, dissertation committees, and Professor Rusk, who was the professor of American literature. I was on several of those committees. I was on a lot of committees, Alan Evans and Everett D. Green students. I was on committees for Snyder in the history of American philosophy. So I learned a lot, but I worked harder than I did at Beloit. And so I decided that if I were invited to any other university that I would like to teach in, I would just accept it, say nothing about it. So when I was invited to come to Wisconsin, I really had no hesitation. I always thought I would I'd never been to a public university or a public college. I'd always been only to places like Harvard and Smith and then Columbia. So I thought if I was ever invited to a good state university, I would be interested in going. And also, if I could walk through the campus rather than just commuting from Westchester County. So I just accepted this invitation, and I told Erling Hunt, the chairman of the Department of Teachers College, and Carlton Hayes, the chairman of the Department of Columbia, that I had accepted this invitation. Well, the Columbia people were then terribly aroused. They said, well, if you don't like these two jobs, we'll be very glad to have you just on the Columbia side. And I said, well, it's too late now. I've accepted it. Then I had a letter from John Kraut, who by this time was the executive officer, saying that Alan and he would like to talk with me at the Chicago meeting of the HA. This is 1942 Chicago meeting. And I did talk with them, and they said the whole history group at Columbia wants you to come back.
and won't you do it? And I said, well, this is my first year at Wisconsin. I don't think I would like to leave after 1 year. And so, thank you very much, but no. And the next year I was invited to go to Cornell, and I had the same feeling when I was invited to Cornell that I've only been at Wisconsin a short time, I ought not go. But the next year I was invited to go to Northwestern, and there I was able to do something for my friend Ray Billington, who was my successor at Smith.
Mm.
And I said, when I told the Northwestern people, no, I was going to stay Wisconsin, I said, why don't you consider Ray Billington? He's in this field too, social history and some intellectual history. And he would be very good. He's an excellent teacher. And so they invited him out, and they he accepted the job. So I think that's probably the way my first honorary degree was from Northwestern. I assumed it was because Ray's hand was in it.
I wanted to ask you this. This tape's just about over, but I remember something I thought particularly poignant. I think it was your last semester teaching, or next to last semester, when the Dow Chemical thing took place, and if I remember correctly, you told me that you were in your office in Bascom, and you got a whiff of the tear gas, and some student came in with his head bleeding. Would you tell that?
Well, yes. There was that, and also I had I was giving these small so-called seminars of about 15 undergraduates, and I had one. That was true. The tear gas did come in, and I saw the big crowd out in front of the Commerce.
Mm-hmm.
And then I had a class, and I didn't know whether any students would come to it or not. These were undergraduates and upperclassmen, but probably not. Some of them did come, and then two or three boys came in with their heads all bloody and terribly beaten up. And I said, well, look, you go to the emergency of the university clinic right away. I said, you've got to have this taken care of and stay. They're all bloody and terribly banged up. And we were so upset we didn't go on with the class.
Mm.
We just said, we don't feel like it. We can go on with it. This is very upsetting.
Mm.
Two or three boys come in all banged up. So I escaped, I guess, the most troublesome time, which came the next year.
Mm-hmm.
But it was well underway the last year I was here.
That's what I was thinking. It had started by the disruptions.
I was very much against the Vietnam War. On the other hand, I never liked mob demonstrations, which always frightened me. I never saw a lynching mob, but one, my mother and father described one in Omaha in 1921.
Mm.
There was a terrible lynching.
Mm.
And my mother didn't see it, but my father happened to be downtown at the time. He didn't stay to see the end of it, but it was a terrible experience for him, and as he told it to me, for me, that it happened right in Omaha, middle western city. I think it was 1921, as I remember. At the same time, the big ones in Chicago. So I always had a horror of mobs and violence. Mm. And then I could understand some part of the feelings of these students about the Dow Chemical and about the university's involvement in preparations for the continuation of this war in Vietnam. But that I sympathized. I didn't sympathize with confronting the police.
Mm.
When you confront the police are bound to have the better of it. They've got the tear gas, they've got all the things. It's an uneven fight. They're just very vulnerable.
And they're bound to react.
They're very vulnerable. And the police are brought. So I've studied enough of violence and nonviolence to know that I didn't approve of this, even though I had sympathy with the purposes that they were doing. That's what I told my students, that I couldn't sympathize with their inviting or getting themselves into a situation where they were having confrontations, where they could never win that way. And it was not effective, in my view, in putting across what they wanted to put across. They were too vulnerable, and the results would be bad for them and bad for the cause that they were trying to support.
Well, of course, bad for the university.
They didn't, but in talking with them, I wasn't always convincing to them. They said, no, there are times when the only thing, if we want to protest, is the only way there is. We can't really protest in any other way that we'll be heard. And so I...